things that resulted in the Hollywood 10 blacklisting.
A California newspaper says that Ronald Reagan, during his acting days in the 40s, served as an informant for the FBI, supplying names of people who allegedly followed the communist line in Hollywood. The San Jose Mercury News said Reagan's first wife, actress Jane Wyman, was also an informant.
Gonna rise up, take what's there. 'Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
This Week in Radical History is produced from the mobile fortress of Glee Glee Studios.
What we got to say, yeah. Fight the power. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What we got to say, yeah. Fight the power.
Inspiration for this piece came from the Slingshot Organizer, and much of the radical info can be found in the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
Come on! Yo, check this out, man.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
Hey!
We'd like to recognize a lot of great work that we're gently lifting for this week's show. On This Day in History is produced in the Neighborhood Network of Columbus, Ohio, and some audio is being borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI New York, which you're about to hear right now.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, July 6, in 1887, David Kalakaua, the king of the Hawaiian Islands, signed the Bayonet Constitution. The document greatly shifted the power from the king to an all-white cabinet and catered to the demands of the white Americans and Europeans who already had a monopoly on the Hawaiian sugar economy. It also created new guidelines for voting based on income that excluded two-thirds of Native Hawaiians. King Kalakaua was forced to accept the new constitution, knowing that the threat of a violent overthrow was imminent if he resisted. 6 years later, the white cabinet overthrew his sister, Queen Liliuokalani, who had come to power after the king's death. Hawaii was later annexed by the U.S. in 1898. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Say it, say it, say it.
This Week in Radical History, starting July 7th. On this day in 1535, Sir Thomas More, a humanist and author of Utopia, after refusing to acknowledge the King of England as the head of the church, loses his to the king's axemen. Also on July 7th, 1846, the colonial power in the New World known as America declares war on Mexico and steals California and parts that would be known as Texas. Also on July 7th, 1892, in the land of free speech, the song A Man Named Carnegie appears during the Homestead Strike. It is during this strike that anarchist Henry Bayer is arrested and sent to prison for 5 years for distributing leaflets. Also on July 7, 1903, in Kennington, Pennsylvania, 27,000 workers abused by their employers go on strike, and the child textile workers protest in what is called the March of the Mill Children. All are malnourished, many missing fingers all the way up to the knuckles. The strikers march in the factory owners' neighborhoods. In one of the newspapers, it is quoted about the strike saying, "I called upon the millionaire manufacturers to cease their moral murders, and I cried to the officials to open their windows opposite. Someday the workers will take possession of your city hall, and when they do, no children will be sacrificed on the altar of profit." Labor organizer Mary Harris Mother Jones leads the children from Philly to the summer home of President Roosevelt, who refuses to meet with them. Also on a state in 1923 in France, the Paris Dental Museum of M. Wangrum is bombed by neo-nihilists. Quoting the nihilist, "Once bitten, always fearful." Also on July 7, 1947, Roswell crash occurs. Government reports that it is a flying saucer that crashed. Then a day later, "Nah, it was only a weather balloon." Also on July 7, 1966, after the Tompkins incident and later proven in Pentagon Papers that it was a CIA-created lie, governors meet and vote 49-1 to back LGB's plan of a full-scale war in Vietnam. Also on July 7, 1979, 2,000 Indian activists and anti-nuclear demonstrators march through the Black Hills of South Dakota to protest the development of uranium mines in their sacred lands. In the summer of 1987, after right-wing favorite Lieutenant Colonel Ali Noor's testimony captivates the nation during Iran-Contra hearings, it was revealed that he was ordered by the Reagan administration and then CIA chief former President George Bush Sr. to sell arms for hostages, directly going against the resolution passed in Congress. Don't worry, like all right-wing criminals, he'd be pardoned by the president the next Christmas. Also on July 7, 2001, Amnesty International says China has executed 1,781 in the last 3 months, yet they somehow win the bid for the Olympics that is planned this year. This week in radical history for July 8, 1520 in the New World, Battle of Atampan in Mexico. It wasn't really a battle, but more like a massacre as the Spaniards slay over 20,000 Aztecs. Also on July 8, 1932, depression hits its low point as the Dow Jones Industrial Average drops to 41.22. How low will it go this time? Don't worry, the capitalists have their way of making money.
The Public Works Administration, or WPA, was inaugurated on this day in the United States in 1933. It was a massive federal employment program designed to help jumpstart the economy, not by giving tax incentives to industry or tax cuts to the rich, but by hiring hundreds of thousands of the unemployed to build bridges, roads, hospitals, schools, and affordable housing. For 6 years, the WPA paid out more than $2 billion a year in wages, saving many from abject poverty and homelessness.
Also on July 8, 1945, 8 German POWs shot to death and 20 wounded in Salina, Utah, when prison guard Private Clarence Pertusi sprays a tent on the sleeping prisoners with machine gun fire. Don't worry, like Abu Ghraib, Camp Gitmo, Mailai, Fallujah, and Haditha, the military is good at covering its butts and protecting its soldiers, even when they commit war crimes. Lastly, for July 8, 1980, Congress never passes on an opportunity to screw Native Americans as they enact the Hopi Navajo Forced Relocation Act to, quote, solve, unquote, the problem of impending access to coal deposits in Big Mountain, Arizona. Navajo families at Big Mountain continue their resistance to this day. This week in radical history for July 9, 1917, when Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman are charged with conspiracy to defeat registration under the conscription law, they are sentenced today to serve 2 years in prison, pay fines of $10,000 each, and quietly deported to Russia at the expiration of their prison terms. U.S. Marshal McCarthy says, this marks the beginning of the end of anarchism in New York. Also on July 9, 1945, 3 black members of the U.S. Women's Army Corps Reserve are beaten in Elizabethtown, Kentucky bus terminal for sitting in the white section when the black section is full. The policemen involved are, of course, acquitted. Also on the date July 9, 1955, the Russell-Einstein Manifesto on Danger of Nuclear War is published in London. Bertrand Russell and Albert Einstein and 7 other prominent scientists warn of nuclear war could, quote, put an end to the human race, unquote. Einstein would later say, only 2 things are infinite, the universe and human stupidity, and I'm not sure about the former. Also on July 9, 1958, in Lebanon, USA invades with 14,000 troops and armed with nuclear-capable rockets to protect American interests.
The American feminist pioneer Alice Paul died on this day in 1977 at the age of 92. Paul is thought to be one of the most influential activists on behalf of women's rights in both the United States and worldwide. In 1913, Paul and others organized a suffrage march in Washington, D.C. to coincide with President Woodrow Wilson's inauguration. The effort gained national attention when hostile male onlookers physically attacked the peaceful march. Paul was jailed and tortured along with other suffragists after staging a silent picket in front of the White House during Wilson's term. After women finally gained the right to vote in the U.S. in 1920, Paul went on to pressure the United Nations to add an equal rights clause in the UN Charter. Then she authored the Equal Rights Amendment and campaigned for its passage in the U.S. until her death. That amendment was passed by the Congress in 1972, but was never ratified by enough states to become law. The ERA has been reintroduced in each Congress ever since, the text of which reads simply, "Equality and rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged in the United States or by any state on account of sex." And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, July 9th. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
On this day in radical history for July 10th, 1894, 14,000 federal and state troops finally succeed in putting down a labor strike against the Pullman Place Car Company, which had been a peaceful strike until July 7th, when the federal troops intervened on the side of industrialists in Chicago. During the Pullman strike, federal troops killed 34 American Railway Union members. Also on July 10th, 1962, peace-loving American government rejects Soviet's proposal to complete and general disarmament of nuclear weapons. This is one of only many similar attempts by Russia to defuse the armament race that is rejected by the U.S. throughout the 50s and 60s.
This is your radio reporter, Hannah George. On this day, July 10th in 1966, 2 years before his assassination, Martin Luther King Jr. was leading the Chicago Freedom Movement against the city's segregated slums. This was the first time that King and the SCLC had tackled desegregation issues in the North, and to their surprise, it proved to be a more hostile battleground than the outright racism of the South. King's experience in Chicago caused him to reshape his views on American capitalism and the process of change. When King was later criticized for involving himself in the anti-Vietnam War movement and the Poor People's Campaign in America, he argued that there was a direct relationship between poverty and racism and American militarism and imperialism.
Also on July 10, 1976, KKK members near Georgetown, Illinois, gather for a friendly neighborhood cross burning. The meeting got off on the wrong foot. They went to plant the cross, only to find it was too heavy to move. It took the white-robed merrymakers 3 hours to chop the cross down to a portable size. Then they planted it, only to find it would not light. Finally, they gave up and went home, somewhat crossed. Two more items on July 10, 1895 in New Zealand. French secret police blow up the Greenpeace Rainbow Warrior anti-nuclear vessel in Ockham Harbor, killing one activist. State terrorism at its finest.
On this day, July 11th in 1656, the first Quakers arrived in the American colonies. They were Anne Austin and Mary Fisher, both of whom were escaping religious persecution in England just as the Puritans had less than 30 years earlier. They sailed at first to Barbados, where they were greeted warmly, then to Boston, where they were immediately arrested and held in isolation without adequate food and water for 5 weeks before being deported back to Barbados, their books and clothes and other effects having been confiscated and burned. Shortly thereafter, laws were enacted in the colonies which forbade Quakerism and in some cases even allowed the death penalty to be imposed upon those who practiced the religion in defiance of the law. In 1905, a civil rights movement was begun on this day in Ontario near Niagara Falls as one of America's great intellectuals, African-American socialist W.E.B. Du Bois, held a founding meeting of an organization he called the Niagara Movement. The organization was small and underfunded but grew steadily over the next several years, and in 1909 was renamed the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP. Its founding principles were a demand for equal voting rights for all American citizens and the right to protest against injustices and a call for full and equal respect under the law for every American.
Also on July 11, 1947, 8 black prisoners killed at Brunswick, Georgia for refusing to work in snake-infested swamps without boots.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, July 11th in 1954, the first known chapter of the White Citizens Council was formed in Indianola, Mississippi, and within a few months had spread to the rest of the Deep South. The White Citizens Council had white supremacist beliefs similar to that of the KKK, but they used economic pressure and political tactics rather than direct violence in order to oppress people of color. The council was often referred to as an uptown clan, as many members were in positions of power. Its successor organization, the Council of Conservative Citizens, is still actively promoting many of the same racist principles today. And some people argue that America's racist legacy is in the past.
Also on July 11, 1955, Congress, wanting to show how much different they are than the godless commies, ordered all American currency to state, "In God we trust."
And in Haiti on this day in 1990, hundreds of thousands of citizens demonstrated in support of the country's newly elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was facing a mounting campaign of violence and intimidation by the Tonton Macou, or the former militia created under the previous Duvalier dictatorship. Aristide was a proponent of social reforms, many of which, like raising Haiti's minimum wage and ending government corruption, ran afoul of U.S. policy interests, and when Aristide was overthrown in a coup less than 2 years later, he accused the United States of having supported it. Aristide was later returned to the presidency when his illegitimate successor was ousted by a popular uprising, but after questions were raised regarding the legitimacy of the next round of elections, the U.S. staged another coup and abducted Aristide and deported him to the U.S. client state of the Central African Republic. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, July 11th.
This day in radical history for July 12th, 1892, state militia moved to break the 12-day labor strike against the Carnegie Steel Corporation in Homestead, Pennsylvania. Strikers protesting wage cuts of 18% to 26% suffer 7 deaths in the attacks by the Pinkerton Private Police Force of Carnegie Steel Company. Hey, but look, Carnegie was kind enough to donate all that money in the Great Carnegie Hall, all off the backs of the workers. Also on July 12, 1917, final days of the vigilantes deport the striking mill workers in Bisbee, Arizona. Yesterday, authorities sealed off the county, seized the local Western Union Telegraph office in order to cut outside communication, and several thousand armed vigilantes rounded up 1,186 miners of the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, and began herding them into manure-laden boxcars to be shipped off and dumped in the New Mexico desert. Also on July 12, 1951, Adlai Stevenson calls up the National Guard to stop the rioting in Securo, Illinois. A mob of 3,500 tries to keep an African-American family from moving into the city. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, July 12th in 1967, tension between whites and blacks in Newark, New Jersey exploded into 6 days of rioting when the police arrested and beat a black cab driver named John Smith. The rioting left 23 people dead and thousands of others were injured or arrested. Although Newark had quickly become one of the first major cities to have a majority black population, political power remained in the control of whites. The black community was plagued by police brutality, unemployment, poor housing conditions, and poverty. After the riots, much of Newark's white population left the city, and poverty continued to plague Newark's black community. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it.
Also on July 12, 1996, two Ontario men are beaten and dragged in San Antonio, Texas by police who think they are gay. This has been This Week in Radical History. Welcome to more stations at a pickup and a little ditty, radicalradio.org and KLGR 95.3 FM in Boulder. Inspiration for This Week in Radical History came from the Slingshot organizer. Google the Slingshot Collective for more information. Much of the radical info presented on the show can be found at the Daily Bleed website. Google the Daily Bleed for more radical info. This has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Glee Glee Studios. A reminder of what anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman once said, if voting ever really changed anything, they would have made it illegal. So until next week, as always, I'm yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, "Oh, I voted." For a minute that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff. Who, you know, the only way you cure that, death, bloodshed. I don't advocate it, but I see that it's really the only answer.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. Today we hear an exclusive presentation by Palestinian expressive therapist Kitam Edelby. Kitam is completing her PhD through Lesley University while actively conducting an expressive therapy program she created in the West Bank of Palestine. While in Cambridge this summer doing her academic coursework, Kitam spoke at a fundraiser describing her program, and we were there to record it for This Week in Palestine. It begins with an introduction by Susan Jacoby.
Kitam never knows on any particular day whether she is actually going to be able to make it to a training session or to a workshop because she might be stopped by the Israeli army. And the other thing we need to know is that every single participant in her programs experienced the same kind of fear and anxiety. And what the program does is it works, it is so deeply participatory that it increases the resiliency of every participant to be able to confront the harsh occupation that is their daily life. So just to be very brief, to bring you to last year. When Hitam was started at Lesley University many years ago here in Cambridge, she had this vision, this dream, to do a mobile expressive therapy art bus. And very soon after she got back to Palestine, in fact, a fully refurbished art bus was donated to her to use to travel over, to travel to kindergartens in the West Bank. And during that early period with the art bus, she trained 20 teachers in using expressive art, expressive therapies in kindergarten on the bus. And she also worked on a manual to provide suggestions for parents and for teachers to work with children, provided lots of different possible activities to use for children with all sorts of different issues and problems. That manual is still being used, it's still being refined, it's still being worked on as it's used. But after 2 years of a very successful program with the Art Bus, it became clear that running a bus in this condition of intensified impoverishment in Palestine was just not workable. It was way too costly to try to keep that bus on the road. And also, given the conditions in Palestine, the bus couldn't even get to a lot of villages. Children had to walk to meet the bus. So what's happening now with the bus is that it is still a very cheerful, very brightly colored space that kindergartner programs still come and work on that space. And the original group of 20 teachers that Hitam trained are now completely independent using expressive therapies program. And there's a lot, and I'm sure, I hope Hitam will talk about this more, how this program has just been growing and growing organically. These teachers are now using these methods and these techniques in their own lives and in their classrooms and in their communities. But when the bus had to stop traveling around, nothing stops Hitam. She just expanded the program using her own car. And now, instead of just working in kindergarten settings, she is working with a whole range of children, adolescents, bereaved mothers, children with a big range of emotional and behavioral problems, and also a whole other area that she showed people in Palestine that these techniques will work with children with very severe disabilities. So this program is just growing and growing and growing. I'll let Hitam tell you about her work with Bedouin villages.
It warms my heart to see you all there and here. And thank you so much for being here and for making the time and the effort. And I'm very...
Back at you.
Yeah, literally. Susan said that I never ever know about the date or the time or... the minute that I will arrive in the place because of the obstacles, but I knew the date that I will arrive here. I arrived on time, and it was Saturday night, and Kathy and Jan were there waiting for me. Yay. And thanks to Kathy and Jan for welcoming me and for making me feel home. I'm not going to talk a lot. I'm going to talk briefly, and then you can ask whatever you want if you have any questions. Or I will start a little bit to talk about the projects that I do with women. And unfortunately, Neff, who volunteered in Palestine a few weeks ago, didn't get the chance to see those women because the project at that time was finished with them, the bereaved woman, whom I met once a week for almost 9 months. But usually in Palestine, when the summer comes, women stop their outdoor schedules. They want to be home with their kids and to take care of their kids, especially under our circumstances. So the bereaved woman project stopped 3 months ago almost, and hopefully we will renew it beginning of September after the kids go back to school and the mothers have more time for themselves and have more freedom to do whatever they want to do. In my opinion, from my experience, it was a successful project with them because for them it was an opportunity to breathe and to cry and to laugh and to write poems for their kids and to write letters for their kids. It was an opportunity to say that I can't handle it anymore. Mm-hmm. It was an opportunity for them to say that here I feel myself. Mm-hmm. Here I am back to myself. Here I want to be every week. Here I want to remember my husband and my child every week. So, I will be back to them, and I will try my best to give them the opportunity, yes, to cry, and yes, to laugh, and yes, to love, and yes, to write, and yes, to paint, and yes, maybe also to sing and dance. With the adolescents in the refugee camp, in Qalandia refugee camp, who I met once a week, definitely I will be back beginning of September. They are now on vacation for 2.5 months. 10 boys who come from a desperate refugee camp where, I don't know if you heard of Qalandia refugee camp. And you probably saw it, or you probably across via that. I call it monster, which is... Yeah. That's just even small word. So Qalandia refugee camp locates, actually the checkpoint located on the entrance of the refugee camp. Mm. The refugee camp was there and the checkpoint came. There I work now for almost 2 years, and there I will continue working all my life as long as I get the chance to do that. And there, Nat also was with me, with his guitar, and with the boys, we played the music, and we sang. And I thank you, Nat, for being with me, for also bringing some happiness and some pleasure and some joy to these boys. Some of them lost their relatives, some of them were imprisoned, and some of them about to lose relative or to lose father or to be imprisoned again. Hopefully not, but nothing guaranteed, nothing is guaranteed. With these boys, I do drama and I do expressive art, and sometimes we do nothing, we just sit and chat, which is okay. We do music activities, and hopefully next year I will do with them also playback theater. Yeah. Yes, this is the plan, and playback theater gonna be my PhD research using playback theater with adolescents in Qalandia refugee camp. This is the plan. So I'm preparing them. I'm doing drama activities with them. and I'm doing improvisation activities with them, so we can hopefully next year, beginning of next year, start the playback theater program. There are 10 between 15 and 16. They all were born in the refugee camp, but of course they are refugees, and they all came from outside. Their parents, they are the third generation in the camp. So their parents were born as refugees also in Colombia. It's a big refugee camp. It's very crowded. It's very polluted. But they have hope, and I have hope. And they see the light that I see, and I'm going to see the light all the time in order to be back and switch on the light again. The Bedouin group, I started to work with them almost 8 months ago. Hamda, who initiated the program, Hamda volunteered with me with my mobile art car, and she took me to many Bedouin places where I couldn't go alone by myself. It's a conservative society. It's conservative community. You have to have someone either from the village or the community or is familiar to them to take you. I contacted Hamda. Hamda was there for me. She took me to many places, and she worked with me. A couple of months ago, Hamda graduated as a social worker from Al-Quds University, and she had a dream. When somebody has a dream, the dream has to become real. I had a dream. I know that. I know how dreams come real. I know how dreams come true. They don't come true just like that. They need the love, they need the support, they need the money, they need... So Hamda contacted me and she said, I have a dream and I want you to help me. I said, Hamda, give me 2 hours. I will be there. In 2 hours, I was with Hamda in a very dirty, ugly, neglected van. She said, this is my dream. I said, this is our dream now. We cleaned the van, we painted the van, and we got some furniture, some art material, and some music instruments, and we started. Nowadays, the van opens its doors 5 days a week. For kids, for mothers and young women. Sunday through Thursday. Some come in the morning, some comes afternoon. We do art. We do courses. The UN also counselors help us. Some teachers come and help. Kids come and play. The young women come every week. The young women who I meet with come every Thursday for 2.5 hours to do expressive art therapy sessions. And again, Nat, with his guitar, was with me and danced and sang with him. And they liked it to have a young man sing for them and sing with them. So, just very brief, quick evaluation that I had with the group before I came. And they said, Manal said, the van gives me the opportunity to spend quality time with kids. This makes me and makes them happy. Soraya, after I finished the school, I was basically home. Right now, I am more social. Coming to the van and meeting with other ladies and working with these children is so much helping me to get out of the house. I am also learning a lot from both women and the children. Hanan said, I love the idea that we discuss stuff here. Each has her own ideas. We share them even when we argue or disagree on some issues. Iman said, I feel the difference between the beginning and now. Look to what we reached. We have a space where we meet and chat, a space where we empower ourselves, a place where we laugh and get some fun. And here I meet with a variety of women whom I never interacted with before. Although we all come from the same village, but occasionally we meet and do things together. This van gives me the opportunity to learn about my own society and get close to it. Hamza, I am a bit stranger. I came from another village. Being here with the group helped me adjust and feel more comfortable. The group helps me to feel part of them. Su'ar, I left the village when I got married, but I come once a week because of this project, because of this van. It empowers me, and I will keep coming. Shadia, the courses, the discussions, the games, and the activities that we make in the van are all encouraging me to get out of the house. I rarely went out. Now I have a reason. Khawla, through the van, I managed to meet with people and organizations who visit us, help us, and do what they can to support us. I am aware now of so many people who are willing to help. Asma, honestly, I come here for fun. I so much enjoy the music, the dance, the games, and the food we gather for. Hamda, who initiated the whole idea. I'm happy to announce that I had a dream, and my dream was achieved. She said to the group, I tell you this, dreams come true. You all can dream, and one day it will come.
Now, just anything you want to ask, Yvonne. Kathy, do you have any specific question you want to ask?
Okay. I locate where I locate because I want to reach Qalandia refugee camp. So I live very close from the camp, so it could be easier for me to get in. But I do have to go to Jerusalem, also to do some work in Jerusalem, and in order to reach Jerusalem, I have to go through Qalandia checkpoint or Hizma checkpoint. Yeah. Qalandia checkpoint is the monster one, is the most horrible one. I avoid that and I go through Hizma checkpoint. Hizma checkpoint is available for Jerusalem ID and the settlers. Since I am white with blue eyes and blonde hair, they assume that I am a settler and they don't stop me. Except once when I had American friends with me. This was very strange. My friend came from Maine, Al Miller, and another friend from Santa Barbara, they came to my wedding, and we went through Hezma, and they stopped us, and they checked their passport, and they didn't believe me that I was never, ever stopped there. I said, this is the first time they stopped me. But this is the easiest way for me. When the checkpoint is fine and smooth, I am in Jerusalem in less than half an hour. When the checkpoint is disaster, either I don't get there, or it takes me 1.5 hours or 1 hour or 1.5 hours. But we are used to it. I close the windows, I put my music, I listen to my music, and I wait. I want to reach my point, so I have to be patient. I want to go to the Bedouin woman. I see no checkpoint. I just see them. Because if I see the checkpoint all the time, I don't leave home. Yeah. If I think about checkpoint all the time, I don't leave home. If I think about the checkpoint all the time, I do no work.
Yeah.
I just clean home and do my plans and talk to my husband. This is not what I'm studying for, and this is not what I was born for, and this is not me. Right, Nat?
Right.
Right. So, wherever I went, Nat was with me, and we both were lucky that we didn't face obstacles. The road, when he was there, the road went smoothly, and we reached our points. And so this is part of our journey. This is part of being Palestinian. Actually, we make fun. Wow! Today, the checkpoint was really easy. Oh. So it's, you get used to it. You get used to it. It's not that we accept it. It's just we learn how to deal with it. That's all. And honestly, Leslie, and being at Leslie in the Expressive Art Program helped me a lot. Yeah. How? It helps me to work on myself, to see the beauty in me, to see the beauty in the people I work with. I admit it. And to see that, yes, I can do it despite all the ugly wall, the ugly checkpoints. Mm-hmm. I can do it. I can make it. I can't change the world, but I can do little things. Mm-hmm. I can't reach everybody, but I can reach some.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, did you have more?
I think Jordi also had.
Okay, go ahead.
I want to say something that one.
Okay,
go ahead. That's
Jordi.
What kind of support have you gotten from Leslie?
From Leslie? The whole program that I have, the Expressive Art Therapy Program, being in that program and doing what I did, and the support that I got from the professors, the beautiful assignments I wrote, the beautiful feedback I got, honestly, I feel that it encouraged me and gave me the power, it empowered me, and made me think differently, made me see things differently, made me deal with things differently. It's about art therapy. If I do art therapy with others, I can do some art therapy with myself.
Kathy, did you
not? I don't always succeed, but in most cases,
So I just am sitting here full of a lot of very strong feelings. I knew Hitam when she first came to the States at Leslie, where my friend Mary Ignazi and I are both teachers. And I met this Palestinian woman who had such a good spirit, who was in a good mood most of the time. And here I'm like irritated because the orange line didn't come on time. So, you know, or somebody did something minor that offended me. And it's, this is somebody who has been a source of inspiration to me from the time that she arrived at Leslie, and just has a quality of strength and resilience. And 4 years ago, Susan, Janet, and I went to Palestine. And Hitam,
met us and drove us all around, took us to all these different places, gave generously of her spirit and her time. And we went to this school where Chitam worked with the students and the teachers. I just want to tell you a story about this school. If they saw her coming, they were like, oh, as if Jesus was crossing the waters again.
Jesus
was Jesus, yeah, right. Or Muhammad, whoever. Jesus? Yes, I know. I learned about Jesus. So, I just want to tell you a story about this school that exemplifies the kind of spirit and strength that our dear friend here, Chitam, demonstrates. So we go to the school, and, you know, we got the buses there, and I have pictures on my phone if people want to see pictures of the bus. And everybody, I poured out of the school when Chitam, they saw Chitam was coming. And so I got to talking with one of the teachers. These guys were playing on the bus with the kids, and I went and I talked with one of the teachers. And she shows me the school because I'm interested. I'm an educator. I'm interested in the school. And we come into this room, and there's all this playground equipment. I said, why is the playground equipment in this room? And she said, because the Israelis came, and they did not want us to have our playground. So we brought the playground indoors. And I was like, this is such a metaphor for the courage and the strength, the resilience and the resistance of the Palestinian people. And it was just so powerful to be there. And so Chitam was taking us from her home to the school and the checkpoint. We're sitting there. And of course I know this is daily life for her. And for me, it's an event. It's not my daily life. And I have to say that whatever love and compassion and respect I had for you before I got there only was magnified even greater. So I have a lot of love for this woman, and I encourage you to do whatever you can to support her, because she exemplifies resilience and strength. And so, bless you, my friend.
Thank you. Mentioning the bus reminds me. First, I had a mobile car, and then I had a mobile bus. Sure. Now I have a mobile. Seems that I'm a mobile person. It's all mobile. But guess what? I think somehow the occupation made us creative people.
Yes.
Yeah. So when the whole idea came, because of the occupation, when the occupation stops people from reaching us, we have to reach people. When kids can't come to me, I have to go to them. When women can't get out of the refugee camp or the village, like now we have mobile library, we have mobile cinema, we have mobile toys and games car, and we have my mobile art car, and we had the mobile art bus. We had the mobile freedom bus at the Freedom Theater in Geneva, also the freedom. So it's all mobile. So it has, yeah, so we became, they forced us to become creative.
Yeah.
Mobile people.
Tom, I wonder if you would talk about a little bit about, because as you know, I'm an early childhood educator, and what really struck me very deeply the first time that you worked with boys, it was boys who had been incarcerated, boys who were 12, 13, and 14 years old, and who were incarcerated through an Israeli military. In the United States, if kids do things that are not good, that they need, they go through court, they go through a civilian court. In Israel, all Palestinians, both adults and children, go through a military court.
Yeah.
In Israel, if children do nasty things, they go through a civilian court. And when Tom started working with she was asked by, actually, the UN to work with these boys who were very troubled. We spent a lot of time talking together because it really It was awful to hear what these kids went through. They were tortured, they were abused, they had no legal help, and their parents weren't allowed to see them. And then there were 10 of them. Katam was told, I'm going to tell you, that she could not meet with them without a counselor, that their behavior was such. And I would like Katam to describe that year with Roy.
Yeah, the counselor was there for the first few sessions. After that, he didn't need to be there because they were calmer, they were on time. I get into the room. The room is clean. And they stay after we finish the session. They help me put things in the lockers, clean the tables. And honestly, I was so sad to say goodbye to them after 9 months. Yeah. I couldn't stop myself. I even cried. And they were so touched and a little bit even embarrassed seeing my tears. And I said, it's okay to cry. It means that I love you and I will miss you. And I'm sorry that I can't work with you next year because I have to start a new group. If you're going to be next year in our school, we're going to come to the session. We don't care. I said, I'm sorry, but you can't. They said, we don't ask you. We're going to be there. So, of course, the counselor.
What I wanted to also remember is that the reason these kids were kept in incarceration for so long was that they were asked by the Israeli military to become informants.
Some of them.
Kids who were 12, 13, and 14. Some of them.
Yeah.
And they refused to become informants in their community.
But at least those kids are not in jail anymore.
No, that's right.
Not in jail anymore. Hopefully for good. And this is it's like a mission for me to keep them alive, far from street, far from the checkpoint, at least for a couple of hours when they are with me, because I can't guarantee what they do when I am far from them or when I am out of the camp. But at least I know that with me, they feel the hope again. They do something that they never did before, and they hear something that they never heard before. I keep saying, we have to live for Palestine. Yeah. Palestine needs us alive. And I always keep saying that to remind them, if you love Palestine, you have to live for Palestine. Not only to die for Palestine. If you die, you die, you go. But if you live, you do something. So hopefully the message is there, and hopefully they follow it. So we'll see next year. Hopefully I will see all of them alive.
Didn't you do a second year then with those boys? But you did give them a second year.
No, just a few sessions. I couldn't. I had to start a new one. I can't continue with the same because there is plenty. Yeah.
Do you get to follow up? I mean, to hear about them
the same, if I am in the same school, yes, I can follow up. Like the group that I finished work with, I follow up with the counselor because it's the same counselor who joins my new project. So I keep, and I see them, and they jump when they see me. I see that, yeah. They try all the time to come and open the door, but you know. They try to test me all the time. Any other questions? Or you are bored?
No, something basic. Yeah. Susan, you referenced a resource library, something? What were you talking about?
Well, Hitam wants to be able to, you know, Palestine is so impoverished that the schools don't have extra things like this. That
most schools, some schools,
the private schools, right? And so Hitam would like to have some of the materials that she has to borrow. You know, if some kid really could work with a particular manipulative, to leave it there so the teacher can work with that child over a couple of months, that Hitam doesn't have to take it back at the end of the session to go to the next school. So it's having more of the materials that Hitam introduces to teachers to use for the first time. Wouldn't it be great if the teachers could then have that to continue to work with this? And the other thing that Hitam didn't say is that, you know, a lot of teachers that she works with call up and say, well, I have a kid that just blah, 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 has this particular thing, this issue that's come up. What can I do for that child? So there's a lot of individual counseling that goes on or individual advice giving. You know, so if Hitam can say, well, this is an activity that really works for this child, something that she or he can get really engaged in, wouldn't it be great if that child could still have access to that Sam or that manipulative or that, you know, paint or whatever, or musical instrument? But, you know, we need more resources to enable the resources to be available to a larger population.
I had the opportunity for a couple of years before I started the PhD program to train counselors to do expressive art with clients and students. During the last year, because I was totally booked for these projects and for school, I had to stop the counselors training. Hopefully next year, if my schedule will allow me to do so, I will go back to train counselors. When I train counselors ask for materials to have in school so they can conduct and implement these art activities with the students. Most schools don't have them. Some, yes. The private school, I can tell you that they are in very good condition in Palestine. But the Onorwa school, the UN school, and the government school, no, they are not. So this is another...
But doesn't the UN have responsibilities for...
But it's very poor.
They're trying to beat people.
Go and see the UN school.
So can you bring art supplies from here? Can we put together some art supplies that you could...
I did it a few years ago. It was so heavy to carry.
Yeah.
I can't find everything now in Jerusalem. Yes, I can. I mean, 3 years ago, even from the Cape, I got tons of stuff. But to grab all this was too much.
Yeah.
And now we have more, most of things we need, we do have. So I don't carry from here. Unless I find something that, like the sand that Eleanor, like Jude and Eleanor, the very heavy sand carried once. Now we have them.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So you don't need to carry them.
So what is the mood? What is the feeling in the places that you're working now?
In the small area where I work, it's a good feeling. If you go out, it's not. It's not at all. People have no single hope that something going to happen or something good going to happen. We expect the worst, and it's not getting any better. But this will not stop us. This doesn't stop me. I'm going to keep doing what I believe is the right thing to do, what I love to do, what I have the passion to do. I can't change governments. I don't do politics. I do art. I love art. I do music. I love music. I do dance. I do drama. This is what I know how to do. I'm gonna do it all my life. Now, next year.
These Bedouin settlements, are they fully settled, or are they?
First of all, they are Bedouin communities.
Yes.
And societies,
yes.
And villages, not settlements.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe that was a point. I tell you why.
Because the settlements were built on their land.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, like this one.
Where they used to have a village,
the Bedouin village that I work where we created this
project and the neglected van. And it's actual van. It was a van. Yeah. But it's solid. It's on, it's the, on the ground. It's stable.
Yeah.
And we, you know, renew it. And we made it a beautiful project. Actually, this village was not there. The people of this village don't come from this village,
right.
From this area, I mean, right. From this neighborhood. They come from another place where they located in their tents.
Yes.
Bedouin in Palestine, in West Bank, they still live in tents.
They do.
This is their life, this is their tradition.
And
we respect them.
They are pastoralists, they still have flocks.
Yes. Yani, not much. I'll tell you why now. So, the people from that village, from that community, who lived in tents and lived on sheep and they had their animals and blah, 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 Ma'ale Adumim settlement wanted to expand. So they were forced from their neighborhood, from their the area they lived in, to the other, to another area, and they were not allowed to live in tents. So they are Bedouins who live in stone houses.
Yes.
It's like confusing, you know, it's not the same life.
Yes.
We are Bedouins, but we live in stone's house. So the daily living, the daily tradition is a Bedouin tradition. But no more sheep, no more grass, no more, you know? So it's... So originally they are not from there because where they come from was taken. To Ma'ale Adumim settlement. Somebody raised hand.
Was that Khan Al Ahmar, the town where you're working, that they're going to demolish this week? It's
Khan Al Ahmar, nearby.
Yes. Oh,
the same story.
Yeah.
In Khan Al Ahmar, Bedouin community lives there. They have their life, live in peace, far from everything. Now they're going to push them out of Khan Al Ahmar because they are building factories there.
Yeah.
And people are struggling and fighting, and we will see blood sooner or later, I'm sure.
Just to share with people, that was also a place. I take students every year, and I took my students there. And they had a playground because they were very near Jerusalem, and so some Italian diplomat came and said, oh, my God, we'll donate a playground. So they came and they put up playground equipment, and this nearby settlement has a drone. Now, I don't know if this is given to them by the government or you just buy a drone on Amazon. They had a drone. They saw the playground being built. They called the police and the army. And while the diplomat was still in the village drinking tea to celebrate the playground, they came and demolished the playground.
What is this?
So
that's
why $15,000 is important.
What is this animus to playgrounds? I don't get it.
They want to leave. They don't want them to stay.
And, you know, if you can't protect your children, that's a reason to leave.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. How is it different from concentration camps? I don't know.
Exactly.
3 years ago, somebody asked me, I don't know whether was it here in the presentation or somewhere at Leslie, are you planning to work with Israeli kids, Jewish kids? I said, yeah, why not, but not now. I have no time. I'm so busy for my people. Honestly, but I will never, ever have a problem to work with the Jewish kids. If we live in normal situations, if we both live in equal situations, if we both have the same rights and the same dignity and the same kind of life. Why not? They are not different from me. I am not that different from them. Their kids are could be my kids as well. Why not?
The way it's being utilized in different populations is really fascinating to me. With the women, I can sort of understand with someone and the desire and the need to have community to be able to express yourself. With the boys who've been in prison, who stood up and did not agree to become informants. I'm interested in knowing what the expressive therapies, clearly it did something, what it did, and I'm interested in whether there are mega themes that it does for everybody, and then it's specialized for the population. I don't quite understand how all this works, but I'm very impressed by it.
I go with the small goals. The smallest goal that I had with these boys is to take them out of the streets for a couple of hours. Because I know when they are not with me, they are clashing with that checkpoint. So this was a big success, to have them at least for a couple of hours every week to be with me outside of the stones, far from the checkpoints. Second, it gave them the opportunity to tell their stories, to talk about their parents, to talk about the prison they were in, to talk about their siblings whom they missed and or lost or passed away because of many, many reasons. Second, the expressive art gave them the opportunity to see how creative they are. When they sing, when they dance, when they paint. Because expressive art, it's not about a product, it's about the process. It's about the process, about doing it, feeling it, and practicing it, and see how beauty in it. So we don't care whether it's so much beautiful or not. We care about you made it. It's yours. Talk about it if you want. Hang it if you want. So it's empowering them gently without forcing them to be fully creative and having a beautiful product.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. So, Putin used nerve agent to try and kill two alleged hard drug addicts in Amesbury last Saturday. Pull the other one, Sajid Javid. Yes, Putin strikes again in Amesbury. At least that's what we're supposed to believe, with the key witnesses being alleged hard drug addicts. So why did it take 4 days to change from a routine bad batch of hard drugs as the Met's anti-terrorism command took over to an act of international sabotage by Putin? And NATO's biennial summit next week in Brussels. What diplomatic nukes will Donald Trump be dropping? Then we have his visiting the Queen next week, next Friday, in fact. Lots of fun and games on this show, I imagine, commenting on that next week. That's Friday the 13th. Followed on Monday week, by the Trump-Putin Helsinki love-in. All the warmongers, particularly the Israelis and Theresa May's deep state friends, they're dreading that. And carried over from last week, human cattle, the slave trade, Liverpool, Bristol and London pioneered this horrific triangular trade to Africa and the Caribbean, with all the blood carefully washed off the decks before the merchants of death returned to Bristol. But where did we get this business model from? Well, the Italians played a key role, first the Roman Empire and then the shadowy merchants of the Venice city-state. Our sister show Dialects on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. Catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk if you like. This week, Bristol's Trident Ploughshares campaign report on their efforts to get the UN vote to ban nuclear weapons implemented. Also, former US Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett's just come back from a briefing from Iranian intelligence. What did they have to say? That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday. You can download it from dialectradio.co.uk right now, if you like. Now, Martin, I guess we have to start, really, don't we, with this incident in Amesbury. What's your thoughts about that? There is some sort of confusion, it seems, about whether this is the same batch of Novichok, if indeed Novichok it is, that caused all the trouble back in May. The only trouble is, of course, that anyone that's a chemical expert, chemical weapons expert, will tell you that Novichok only lasts a few days. It decays and then it loses its potency, so obviously it can't be that.
It can't be that, because if it was Novichok, they'd all be dead. So that's quite clear. And of course, the timing is very suspicious, because, you know, the World Cup's going very well for the Russians, the English team are into the last eight, and then suddenly we're reminded by how much we hate the Russians. And it just stinks. It's very fishy.
But the Anti-Terrorism Command seem to be absolutely clear about what's caused this.
Well, I think, do you know what? I actually believe that this is probably the most likely explanation of this is a psychological warfare operation by MI6. Operation Beluga, we know that there's a whole program called Operation Beluga, because Paul Burrell, who is a French anti-terrorist officer, gave an interview to the press about 2 years ago, said there's a whole operation called Operation Beluga to prevent a rapprochement between Russia and the West, because the military-industrial complex in the West do not want to see peace with Russia, and they're determined to stop it.
And but surely they could be trading with Russia, couldn't they?
Well, in a rational world, we'd be sitting down with the Russians and the Chinese talking about how we could work together to improve the living standards of the whole world population. But you've got to understand that there's powerful forces in the West who do not want that to happen. And they are working pretty hard to prevent it. And one of the problems you've got is that the mainstream in Britain, for example, and most Western countries cannot get their head around the sheer evil manipulation that their own intelligence services are engaged in. There's a whole, you know, people just lose their marbles when they start talking about it. We had Steve Smith on last week, the Tory chap, and he was, it's got to be secret. It's like, what? Why? We can't really, I don't really want to discuss this. People need to know the history of NATO intelligence services to understand that they are actually terrorists, thugs, and very nasty people.
But, I mean, that's... how can you justify what you've just said?
Well, in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s, there were lots of terrorist attacks. There's been at Piazza Fontana in 1969, where nine people were killed by a bomb. The police investigated it all, and Fernando Imposimato, who is the head of the Italian Supreme Court, who died last year, wrote a book about it all that came out in 2012, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres. I don't suppose Theresa May or Boris Johnson have ever
written. There was also
they don't know about this
the stuff. P2 scandal, wasn't there, in the 80s, which really showed that Italy was, in fact, not being run by the elected politicians. It was being run by a bunch of industrialists, media barons, and Secret Service people.
Yeah, and the Secret Service people were planting bombs and killing people.
Plus bankers. Mm. They were running the country. Mm. It was called P2. It was Licio Gelli. He was the fascist who was the chairman of the committee.
Well, he was actually a Socialist Party member, but he was a fascist, didn't he? In all but name. But the fact is, it's on the record that NATO intelligence services, including MI6, are terrorists and murderers. There's nothing to dispute there. It's all on the historical record. But you will find mainstream politicians of any party, they just don't know this
so
stuff.
So what do you make of our Defence Secretary, Gavin Williams? He's come out with... I've got a clip of him in a minute, actually, mm-hmm. coming out with some sort of... it was exactly like Joe Johnson on BBC Question Time a month or so ago, who had something called Siri, which is a little thing on his mobile phone, which tells him things, speaks to mm-hmm. him about policy and about various bits of... I mean, it almost seems to me like it's the... let's have a listen to this clip first and then let's just discuss it, because this is not on BBC Question Time, but this is while he was giving a statement to the House of Commons. His mobile phone went off.
In Syria, the Syrian Democratic Forces, supported by coalition air power, are continuing their campaign. This involves the clearance of desert areas, securing the Syria-Iraq border, and rooting out the remaining several hundred terrorists who remain in outposts in the Euphrates Valley and surrounding areas.
I found something on the web for in Syria. Syrian Democratic Forces supported by premonition.
What a very rum business that is.
An intervention. No, but I do apologise for that. It is very rare that you're heckled by your own mobile phone.
Indeed.
On this occasion, it is a new parliamentary convention, without a doubt.
So there he is. It's got something called Siri on his phone, and it is basically telling him, effectively telling him what to think. You know what I'm reminded of is the Len Dayton novel Billion Dollar Brain, where various people are given orders by a synthesised voice, which is actually a computer.
Well, leaving aside all of that, when he said the Syrian Democratic Forces are carrying on their campaign, that means terrorism. That means killing people. That means planting bombs. The SAS are in there showing them how to do it, how to plant bombs, how to assassinate people, car bombs, all the rest of it. It's mealy-mouthed rubbish. And in actual fact, our intelligence services and armed forces are terrorist criminals.
So Siri is what it's doing, effectively, is it's creating a narrative. The idea mm-hmm. is that all of the senior government people get this thing that's talking at them all the time, telling them what to think.
Well, he's a young fella, isn't he? A whippersnapper. And he's also threatened to bring down Theresa May unless he gets another $20 billion for the armed forces. It's quite clear who runs this country, and it ain't the elected politicians.
Who is it, then?
It's the military-industrial complex and the banks, which we've bailed out for 10 years.
So what about this idea that people in government aren't actually... I mean, this is what it implies to me, this Siri business, is that we're not really getting Gavin Williamson. We're getting is some kind of policy which is remotely contrived.
Well, what I would say about him, he's a non-entity, but he's a spokesperson for the deep state. He's very much their man.
Why do you say that?
Well, because he's not a serious politician in my mind, and we're now pushing to increase. But supposedly there's austerity, and we can't afford libraries or toilets in Bristol. But we're going to have another $20 billion for the armed forces because we're being threatened by the Russians. Absolute nonsense, drivel.
Now, you mentioned briefly there some of this skullduggery done by MI6, but it's quite a good time, I think, to remember the fascinating accusation made by Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister under Mitterrand, that he actually came across to Britain in 2009 when David Miliband was foreign secretary and had a meeting about starting an armed uprising in Syria. Now, the same exact thing happened 2 years later in 2011. That's when the armed uprising began after Gaddafi had been killed. A lot of people then, mercenaries, were brought over from Libya to Syria.
Indeed. And in other words, there's a fairly good prima facie evidence that the British intelligence services started the war in Syria, which has killed nearly a million people, millions of people as refugees and all the rest of it. We did that, and we all want to go out and have a nice cup of tea. Pathetic.
What about Miliband himself, though? Because he went on to run a charity after he left government as foreign secretary.
He did. It's called the International Rescue Committee, and I had to deal with them when I worked in Bosnia. They're basically a CIA front organisation.
Well, OK. What makes you say that?
Because that's what they are.
Well, just go into some detail, Martin. Well, I mean, who are these people, and what evidence?
The International Rescue Committee is actually a Jewish organisation that was set up in World War II to rescue refugees and all the rest of it. And it's, you know, the basic goals of the organisation are sound, but I'm afraid a lot of non-governmental organisations are fronts. They're funded by USAID, which is the US government, and they're basically a front for the deep state in the US.
While I was away, we may managed to miss this story, but the charity was fronted by former Labour Foreign Secretary David Miliband, hushed up 37 allegations of fraud, sex abuse and bribery. Former Labour MP David Miliband joined the International Rescue Committee after quitting politics in 2013. The International Rescue Committee was given £5.4 million in British taxpayers' money. Money given to the charity by the government was then frozen after these allegations. The team was sent to probe claims of wrongdoing in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the IRC. Yet a leaked report from the Department for International Development shows the funding to the charity was cut after direct reporting of fraud and sexual harassment. So is David Miliband a gangster? I mean, what is he?
Well, I think it's quite significant that after having failed in his political career here, he goes to the United States and works for that sort of organisation. I believe he's paid £500,000 a year to work for them. We used to call them Thunderbirds in Bosnia, International Rescue Committee.
The department acted swiftly to ensure the reported misconduct was fully and comprehensively addressed by the IRC and relevant authorities. So he's mentioned by name in the report, and alleged wrongdoing has occurred in this organisation. What they're suggesting here, really, in this report, I'll put a link up to it on our show page, thisweek.org.uk, is that Miliband used his sway with government in order to get money into this organisation, which was then fraudulently, sucked out. Effectively, they weren't doing what they said they were supposed to be doing with the money.
Well, also, of course, he pushed at one stage for an intervention in Syria so that we could carry out vaccinations on Syrian children. So the International Rescue Committee, as led by David Miliband, former foreign secretary of this country, was pushing for intervention in Syria. And so that we could go in there and vaccinate the poor children in Syria.
After threats and legal action, £5.4 million of taxpayers' money was returned from the charity.
Well, as I say, they're funded by the US government and the British government, and they are a front organisation.
I mean, one of the main stories we had last week was the rendition report. That was the Intelligence and Security Committee, and the police are now apparently, and this came out just after our programme last week, are on pressure to investigate. Former military lawyer says the Hague might step in if Britain fails to launch a proper inquiry into the use of torture, because they don't believe that the Intelligence and Security Committee report has gone anywhere near enough to the truth.
Well, there's a whole gulag, a secret gulag out there in which thousands of people are being held, secret prisons. They were in Eastern Europe, Romania, Poland, all over the world. And there's no rule of law. And it's not just that they're overstepping the mark. The intelligence services are orchestrating terrorism, as we know from the Syrian context. At the same time, they're running secret prisons. And, of course, in those secret prisons, people are turned. Yeah? So they say, right, you can go back into the fight in Syria, but you've got to work for us.
Senior Scotland Yard officers are studying a parliamentary report that revealed the true scale of the UK's involvement in torture and rendition. Does that mean that MI5 officers are ever going to get their collars felt, Martin, since the Prime Minister has said that they should not be named and they shouldn't be brought before the Intelligence and Security Committee?
Well, I'm not holding my breath that they're going to have their collars felt, but the principles are quite clear. If you are involved in a government structure that's involved in illegal operations, including torture, then you may think that you're going to retire on a government pension, but it may be that you're not, and you're going to go to prison.
So, the United States and NATO are establishing terrorist bases in Albania.
Yeah, that's right.
The MKO and the MEK. Right, so hang on a minute. I didn't realise that NATO and the United States actually had their own little pet terrorists, but apparently they do, and they're called MKO and MEK. Who are these people? Well, why in Albania?
Well, because they were kicked out of Iraq by the government of Iraq, which is aligned with Iranians. because they're Shia, and they kicked them out. So they were then moved to Albania, which is actually run by the Kosovo Liberation Army, which is another front organisation. And they're not the only organisation that Western intelligence services fund. They fund ISIS, they fund Al-Qaeda. All of that was set up with our taxes. And it's just going on. It's just people... It's staring people in the face what's actually going on, but nobody wants to talk about it apart from on shows like this.
What about Albania? Why there? Because it's not very near to Iran, are supposed to be targeting.
Camp Bondsteel in Albania is the biggest US base outside the US, and it's a major drugs transshipment point. They're moving drugs around all the time on military planes. The Kosovo Liberation Army is basically a gangster outfit, and they run Albania. They run Kosovo. Albania is basically a mafia state, and this is the real world we live in. It's all run by gangsters.
Is it Elvar Hoxha? Elmar Hoxha was the
he was the communist dictator, but he's long gone.
Yeah, but give us a little bit of the background on Albania. Well, it's just north of Greece, isn't it?
It is, and obviously the Italians invaded Albania at the beginning of World War II, which then handed their backsides by the Greeks, and then the Germans had to intervene in Yugoslavia, and eventually Albania became...
It's sandwiched between Greece and Yugoslavia.
Yeah, I mean, eventually the Hoxha regime became... absolutely isolated, because they were opposed to the Yugoslavs, who the Yugoslavs were opposed to the Soviets, and they became pro-Chinese. And then when the Chinese moved to the right, they became anti-Chinese. So they really were the only true Maoist state on the planet. And of course, it was a miserable mess. I used to work with the Catholic Funds for Overseas Development. People used to go over there. Literally every street corner, they used to have a pillbox. There's just pillboxes all over Albania, which were built during that era. And because everybody was their enemy. And, of course, what's happened now, of course, is it's been taken over by the Italian mafia.
So this is basically... this isn't actually very near Iran, is it? It's quite away from Iran. That's so it looks as if it's the only place that the Americans could find to put this base.
That's right, because they used to be based in Iraq, but the Iraqi government don't want them there. They've kicked them out. So they've moved into Albania, because that's, they're basically protégés of the Western intelligence.
Is it possible for them to operate from Albania?
Well, yes,
as terrorists to try and destabilise and blow up trains and things in Iran?
Giuliani, there was a big meeting in Paris last week. Giuliani, who's very close to Trump, was there saying
close to Trump. He's his new lawyer, isn't he? He's his main lawyer now.
Yes, and he said, you're going to be running Iran within 18 months. That's what he said to them, even though they've got no support in Iran whatsoever. But that's where we're going, because our terrorist intelligence services are determined that they're going to overthrow the regime in Iran.
We had a kind of similar thing with Libya and Syria, didn't we? Mm-hmm. We had these exiled governments that were usually based in London, sometimes in Paris. In this case, it looks like this lot are being told by the West, you're going to be the new government. But, I mean, is there any possibility of regime change in Iran?
The things may change in Iran, but MEK have got no real support on the ground in Iran at all.
But do they need support? What happened in Libya? Actually, Gaddafi had a lot of support, but still things didn't go his way, did they?
No, but they do have it. One of the advantages of having a semi-democracy like you've got in Iran is it's quite difficult. Gaddafi didn't really have a solid base, whereas the regime in Iran, disliked as it is by some, is fairly solid, because it keeps asking people, do you want us to carry on? And people go, yes, we do.
So, ultimately, what's going to happen, do you think, in order to try and overturn the Iranian government? Because we've had this whole thing of 7 countries in 5 years, haven't we, that Wesley Clark, the American general, said. Most of those have happened. I think it was one was Somalia, Sudan, various countries were going to be on that list. Iran. And they were on that list. We started with Iraq, but the last on the list was Iran. Do you think it's feasible to overthrow the Iranian government and do what the US and NATO want there?
I don't think it is feasible to overthrow the Iranian government. They can make life very difficult for the ordinary people in Iran, and that's what they're determined to do. And of course, the real flashpoint is going to be Syria, and probably a war in Lebanon, which will then lead to war with Iran. But in actual fact, of course, it's all nuts, because if there is a serious full-on war with Iran, the Iranians can defend themselves.
But it's not
The Gulf is actually a killing
ground. It's not necessarily nuts, is it? Because these people want to take over oil resources and that sort of thing. That's their objective, surely. It's they want to control Middle Eastern oil, especially if there are wars and the oil prices go up. That is going to be a massively important strategic resource.
It is, but I think they've not thought this through. Both the Gulf and the Mediterranean are, in fact, killing fields for NATO's navies. You cannot win, but they still the Israelis want a war with Iran. That's what they want. They've made it absolutely clear that's what they want. Do we want one, British people? Do we want to go to war with Iran to keep the Israelis happy? We need to ask ourselves the question.
Also this week we heard Prime Minister's questions that in Afghanistan, I mean, maybe you could just say what you think about the ceasefire there was for a while last month, Martin, in Afghanistan, because there's been a whole load of Sikhs killed who were standing, one of whom was standing as, I think, a presidential candidate or certainly a political leader candidate in an election there. He was killed too.
Well, I mean, a ceasefire from both sides and negotiation is the way to solve most of these things. And I don't claim to have any special knowledge about what's going on there. But of course, ultimately, the Taliban will have to be allowed to have a say in what goes on in Afghanistan. Of course they will.
So let's go back to Wednesday to Prime Minister's questions to have a listen to this one about Afghanistan and the Sikhs.
Seema Malhotra.
Mr. Speaker, this morning I spoke to the Afghan Sikh community leaders in my constituency following the horrific terrorist attack in the Afghan city of Jalalabad on Sunday, which was a deliberate attack with devastating consequences. The 19 killed included the trustees of the Gurdwara and the only Sikh candidate in the forthcoming elections, Mr. Aftar Singh Khalsa. The Gurdwara had been a safe haven for many persecuted families, and they were on their way to visit the president. Mr. Speaker, at the moment now, the Afghan Sikhs in West London are meeting in prayer and remembrance for those killed, many of whom they knew. Will the Prime Minister update the House on what she is doing to ensure the safety of minorities in Afghanistan, including meeting with the Afghan diaspora about their concerns?
Yeah. Can I say to the Honourable Lady, she's raised a very serious issue, and the terrorist attack that she has referred to was indeed an appalling attack, and as she said, too many were victims and lost their lives as a result of the attack that took place in Afghanistan. And it is important that we ensure that we are providing support, as we do through our contribution to in Afghanistan, which is about contribution to security in the Kabul area, specifically from our forces, but working with others to ensure that the Afghan security forces are able to provide the security and safety for all communities who are living in Afghanistan. There have been tremendous achievements have been made in terms of Afghanistan today compared to what it was like in the past before these efforts were put in. But as she has highlighted, sadly, we still see too many terrorist attacks taking place in Afghanistan, and we will continue to work with our allies and with the Afghan government to prevent these in the future and to ensure that people can go about their daily life in safety and security and confidence.
Well, this ceasefire between the government in Afghanistan and the Taliban is the first time that something so long has happened. This is it was Eid and Ramadan, the ceasefire. It ended last Saturday. But Martin, is a great piece actually in today's Guardian, selfies with the Taliban. Afghan women buoyed by ceasefire snaps. When Taliban fighters entered the cities of Afghanistan after hostilities were put on hold for Eid, some women took photos, a symbol of female resistance. The images quickly went viral, apparently. One of the longest wars of our generation took an unexpected turn last month. The Taliban insurgency accepted the government's call for a 3-day ceasefire during the Islamic festival.
Well, I mean, obviously, I welcome that. It's, you know, a political solution is better than fighting. But, you know, when people go...
Can you just tell us a bit about the reason why we're in Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, we were in Afghanistan because of Operation Cyclone in the 1980s, which was run by MI6 from home turf here. Lots of people recruited from Libya, for example, funneled through Manchester and into Afghanistan. We were killing Russian soldiers. who were trying to bring girls' education, which was obviously wrong. So we've got to kill their soldiers and drive them out, and that's what we did. And then Al Qaeda then morphed into what it's now become, and we set it up with our taxes.
What about Syria, though? Because this week we've heard the Syrian government getting rather irritated with the Americans for hanging around because they're starting to do deals with the Kurds.
Well, listen, the Syrian war should have been over 2 years ago, and Assad, who won the democratic election in 2012, I think it was, should be allowed to run the country. But, of course, we're spending our taxes to kill their police officers and etc., so that they can't do what they want. And, of course, one of the things the Syrians could do, I'm not suggesting they will, they should come here and actually assassinate some of our officials. They'd be within their rights to do so.
Of course they wouldn't.
No, they would.
Criminal.
No, they would. If we're going to send our special forces into Syria to kill their boys, then it's what the IRS is all taking
away.
The
special forces that are in Syria are simply training their opposition.
No, they're not.
Yes, they are.
No, they're training the so-called opposition who've got no legitimacy because they didn't win they've got no electoral support. It doesn't matter.
Are you saying that there was a free and fair election in Syria?
No, it wasn't entirely free and fair, but it was more free and fair than the one in Egypt, for example. And we recognised the government of Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood were banned and all their people were killed and they weren't allowed to stand. And they got Sisi got 40% of the electorate to turn out to vote for him. In actual fact, Assad did much better than that. And, of course, the reality is that Assad is actually popular in Syria. But we are spending our taxes, sending our boys over there to kill their police officers. Maybe they should send some of their boys over to kill our police officers. What do you think?
Wandering around the world, we're going to South Korea now. And a South Korean town has called for the withdrawal of the missile defence shield. Now, I suppose this is... is it really a defence shield, this missile defence shield?
No, it has no strategic purpose in terms of deterring the North Koreans, but what it does is it allows the Americans to have a missile force there which can attack China. That's what it's about. It's a way of sticking their finger in China's eye.
Is that if the North Koreans fire one of their nuclear missiles towards America, one of these THAADs, THAAD missiles, will shoot it down. I mean, surely that the Americans are sensible to have those in there.
No. From the point of the North Koreans, that this missile system, if the North Koreans just lob a nuke over the border to South Korea, it won't have any. You know, this won't work to stop that. But what it does do is it allows them to poke a finger in the Chinese government eyes and the eyes of the People's Liberation Army. That's what it's about. And of course the South Koreans are quite right to say we don't want this here. This doesn't protect us in any way. This is about you having a bloody fight with China.
Pompeo, Secretary of State, is heading over to North Korea. At the same time, the North Koreans are saying actually maybe the United States is no longer imperialist. I mean, this sounds amazing talk, really. North Korea has removed references to the United States as imperialists but continues to speak derogatorily of Japan.
Well, don't forget that the Japanese invaded Korea in 1905 and then put in a brutal occupation regime which ran all the way to 1945. And the Japanese are the traditional enemies of the Koreans. And the Americans and the British who went in there in the 50s just were, backing up what previously went on. The South Korean government was put in power in the 1940s, and they were mostly collaborators with the Japanese, and they started killing the left wing in South Korea, and that's why North Korea invaded, to try and stop them massacring the left wing people in the South Korea, and of course the military governments in South Korea were the collaborators who worked for the Japanese. The same thing happened in Vietnam. The collaborators were put in power. The people who collaborated with the Japanese were put in power by the West to try and keep these people down. And most people have no idea of this history. We just go around the world trying to help people, don't we? With the International Rescue Committee.
Iran is warning Trump's oil ban is self-harm. Have they got a point? Because it doesn't seem as if it's a very good idea for the US to be banning the use of Iranian oil.
No, and of course all the other tariffs and things that they're bringing in, I suspect that we're going to have a really big
there
stock market
talk,
crash,
isn't
in the
there, between about China and Europe actually getting together to collectively negotiate with each other against the United States with this trade war.
Unfortunately, the Europeans are completely in the pocket of the Americans, and they won't do that. They should do that. We should do that. But
well, that's not what Brussels is saying at all. It's actually it's beating its chest, saying stop, 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 Trump.
Yes, everybody's beating their chest saying stop, 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 Trump, especially in the financial markets. If he really wants to go down this road of having trade wars, there is going to be a crash. Of course there is. And then there's going to be a war. We've already got a war. The crash is coming.
The Trump has also repeatedly been pushing, apparently, for the US to be invading Venezuela. Why is he doing that?
Well, the European Union have refused to accept the Venezuelan presidential election result. Because the opposition...
That's not all that helpful, is it?
No, it's not very helpful at all. But then basically the European Union are basically in the pocket of the Americans. That's the reality.
So they're a bit schizophrenic, really, aren't they? I mean, in some ways they're saying, no, we don't agree with the US. We're having these wars between the Germans, particularly, trade wars, that is, and the US. Volkswagen getting very annoyed with the Americans, but apparently that's not real. That's what you seem to be saying.
Well, no, the fact is that what Trump is doing is he's basically banging the table. And he's trying to get the rest
he
of the world.
He was elected to do this, wasn't he?
No, he wasn't.
Yes,
he didn't win the popular vote, Tony.
No, okay, so he wasn't elected.
No, he didn't win the popular vote.
That's not the same thing.
In Syria,
He stood on a platform of these tariffs and actually trying to rejuvenate U.S. industry. That's what people voted for, whether you like it or not. And then he got into power. So there's really no point in you trying to say, well, actually the electoral system is rigged and he hasn't got a mandate. Because he stood on that platform, he's now doing it.
He hasn't got a mandate. Assad's mandate is solid. The Iranian government's mandate is solid. Trump's mandate isn't solid. Putin's mandate is solid. Trump's mandate isn't solid.
I know you don't agree with what he's doing, but surely there is a justification if you've been elected to do something.
No,
to
no,
do
no,
it.
No, no, no,
no.
No? No, 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 because don't forget, he wasn't... This is actually self-harm. It's what the Chinese have said to them. If you want to go to a trade war, then we're going to go to a trade war. But you will be the losers. You will be the losers. Don't forget that the steel tariffs are actually pushing up the cost for the US car industry, for example. So their cars are going to be less competitive because they've got a steel tariff. And ultimately, this is going to cause a crash.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Let's have a listen now to Anton Chaitkin here talking about the slave trade and why it is that the Bristolian merchants got all their ideas from the city of Venice.
New York State had significant slavery as a colonial state, and I think right even a little bit after the Revolution, too. This was Dutch. It was the Dutch influence even after the British were there. Their depot for the slaves was Curaçao. And much of the Caribbean was under this Dutch influence. There was a lot of Jews that had fled from Spain or had been kicked out of Spain and Portugal and had gotten somehow into the Dutch Empire and were in this slave trade. They were carrying out the Kabbalistic religion. But both Holland and England were actually latecomers in this trade. They did not invent the slave trade. The slave trade originates long before there are any blacks in the slave trade. That is, the European trade in slaves starts off with the Roman Empire with various types of large slave operations. And then you have the Venetians, the city of Venice, which is entirely based on occultism and the slave trade, set up by people who were in the slave trade in Rome going to Venice. Venice, Italy, is in many respects the originator of the British Empire. And they're also the originator of many of these concepts of the so-called secret societies. That is, their idea of trade and of business is to have the cheapest possible labor, to have weak governments everywhere, constantly infiltrated by their agents, and to run the world on the basis of banking, secret agreements, and secret government. There's never any constitution or any transparent government. These people in Venice, at a certain point, lost the physical power of their empire, very similar to Britain later on. And so what they did at a certain point was to send Venetian bankers, diplomats, and various types of Venetian agents into Holland and England, and eventually took complete power in those countries. Set up companies in Holland and England modeled on what the Venice slave traders did. The East India Company of both England and Holland, and the West Indies Company of Holland, slave traders and looters of Asia, which is what had been done by the Venetians, but also the black slave trade, because Venice was the first European power to do that. 5 years after Columbus got here, in 1497, 5 years after he first landed in the Western Hemisphere, Venetian merchants made an official arrangement with the King of Spain to begin sending black slaves from Africa, 5,000 a year, into the New World. So hardly any white people had settled down anywhere. And there, you have to understand why they did that. If you think it's just economics, you are missing the whole point of this. It's like talking about Africa. Well, you know, the colonialists go to Africa in order to steal the raw materials. Well, that may be true, but you could get a lot more raw materials out of there if they had an educated workforce, if they lived in decent houses, if they had an education. Why won't you let them have those things? You could make more money if they did. Well, if they did, they wouldn't need you to run their country. It's power. Power. So the Venetians wanted slavery in the New World because they didn't want the Renaissance here. They didn't want freedom. They didn't want the concept of man's freedom. Because you had another city, Florence. That's the originator of many of our concepts of government. That was opposed to Venice. That said, we have a dark world, superstition, epidemics, cities cutting their budgets, running out of money, being looted by bankers, people dying. Half the population of Europe, a third of the population of Europe died in one plague. So the people in Florence said, let's not have this Venetian system running the world. Let's look at these little problems as part of a huge problem. And it's not going to be good enough for us to propose a little solution. Issues. Oh, stick to the issues. Stick to the agenda. No, it's not good enough, they said. We need to solve everything all at once. Nothing else will be practical. Nothing else is going to work. This world is too far gone. So they said, let's build up beauty and science and industry and revive ancient learning and invent whole new industries and get the entire planet moving on a human basis. Make maps. One of these maps goes to Columbus. That's their project. And you have an opposite faction, an opposite idea in Venice. And the Venetian idea of slavery, of secret government, of man's degradation, of cults, of the Kabbalah and so forth, that gets into England. They take over Britain, and eventually Britain becomes the capital of the slave trade.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
And that was Anton Chaitkin. He's the son of Jacob Chaitkin, who was the legal representative to the Jewish Boycott Committee of Nazi Germany in America. Fascinating chap. All sorts of interesting stuff, particularly applicable to our city. And anyway, now I hope we're joined on the line by the former Uzbekistan ambassador, Craig Murray. Hi, Craig. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
We've been chatting about this supposed Novichok discovery in Amesbury. First of all, what's your take on it? Because we're told that it can't be the same batch of Novichok, if it is Novichok, because the stuff decays. Well, anyway, what's your take on what's happened in Amesbury and the coverage of it?
Well, I think the entire story gets increasingly unbelievable. I think we should start from, you know, the very basic fact, which doesn't get enough airing, which is that Novichok is not only made in Russia. It was invented in Russia, in the former Soviet Union, in a facility which had over 300 chemicals weapons scientists working in it from all over the former Soviet Union. So there are Ukrainians, Georgians, people like that who know how to make this. Of course, the one of the main guys in the program subsequently went to live in the United States and published a book on Amazon telling you how to make it. And certainly in both the United States and at Porton Down, it has been synthesized for testing purposes. So several states have made it. Iran has made it and reported it, again, for testing purposes and reported the fact to the OPCW properly. So the substance could be made anywhere. And the complete lie that the government keeps saying that only Russia can make it is just absolute nonsense. Absolute nonsense. And it is a case that it normally is water soluble, in fact, can be washed away. We had the chief medical officer of the UK after the first Salisbury attack telling everyone that they just had to wash their clothes and wipe themselves down with wet wipes, and that would destroy any danger if there were any on anybody's clothing. And now we're told that magically that's not actually true. And the media have managed to find lots of scientists, or chemical weapons experts, so-called, to come out and say, no, they decided it doesn't degrade after all, and it could stay around in a park for 4 months and still be potent. Which is fascinating. I mean, the way the story keeps changing is fascinating, because we were told that the reason the Skripals weren't killed by this incredibly deadly nerve agent was that it had been on their door handle and it had been raining, so it had lost some efficacy. Well, if, you know, in a few hours on their door handle it lost some efficacy in the rain, I think after 4 months it definitely would have lost efficacy. So the whole thing just doesn't add up, and the story just gets stranger and stranger. And what really interests me about this is, you know, all the evidence from social media and from the comments pages of mainstream media newspapers, where public are allowed to comment, the overwhelming number of people simply don't buy it anymore. You know, the people are extremely sceptical of the story that's been put out, because it's been so full of holes and contradictions from the
start.
Now,
you've done your own little survey, haven't you, on Twitter? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I did a survey of 200 tweets with the Amesbury hashtag, simply. I just went to 200 tweets, and which were just, you know, by the general population, anything that looked like it was from a bot or from an official organization of any kind, I excluded. But taking 200 ordinary members of the public tweeting with the Amesbury hashtag, I found that 66% of them were expressing, you know, extreme skepticism or disagreement with what the government is saying. 14% of them, 14%, were agreeing with the government that it's Russia and Russia is to blame. And 20% were just commenting on the story without giving any indication whether they agreed or not. But almost 5-1 was the figure, 66-14, was the figure of people agreeing with the government or disagreeing with the government. People overwhelmingly didn't believe it.
So do you feel a bit like a thought criminal?
It is quite interesting. I must say, in expressing skepticism that Putin would have wanted just before the World Cup to get all this bad publicity in order to bump off, you know, an old retired chap who'd already been let out of prison in Russia years ago. I've received a huge amount of abuse online, and especially from mainstream media journalists, quite interestingly enough. Just asking the questions that, you know, outlets like The Guardian and the BBC refuse to ask seems to really upset them. And I don't know whether it's because it provokes their conscience or why it is. But it is very strange. It's as though you're not allowed to question. So questioning is wrong.
The interesting thing is, Craig, I know you visited the place where this Novichok was supposed to be manufactured. So you really are, in a way, someone who's had some privileged inside knowledge about it. Can you just tell us where that was and what the circumstances were?
Yeah, actually not manufactured, but tested. The old Soviet Chemicals Weapons Institute at Nukus in Uzbekistan, when I was ambassador to Uzbekistan, I actually went to a party to celebrate the end of the decommissioning of the plant and it being rendered safe. Now it's quite interesting, because decommissioning was carried out by the United States and by the United States military mostly. And all the equipment was taken back to the United States. So the Americans certainly have the ability to make Soviet chemical weapons. But also, there were still, you know, there were some of the scientific community from all over the Soviet Union who had been assembled there in the desert at Nukus to at the testing facility. Some of them were staying on, and some of them had married locally and that kind of thing. And I was able to learn, for example, that the Ukrainians were a very large community among the scientists making these chemical weapons, the Georgians, various others. So there again, you know, the knowledge of how to make this is not only confined to Russia. And one possibility might be, of course, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying this is what happened. I don't know what happened any more than anybody else knows what happened. And nobody does know what happened except the perpetrators themselves. The British government certainly have no idea what happened. But one definite possibility is that the Ukrainians, who could certainly make Novichok, may have done this in order to blame it on the Russians. Ukraine is in a proxy war with Russia, of course, at the moment. And they would certainly like to embarrass Putin just before the World Cup. So there are many possibilities. For the British government to state, as they've repeatedly stated, that only the Russians had the motive, is just absolute nonsense.
Now, I would imagine, as someone who's a former diplomat and also who's had access to this place where the Novichok was tested, that you'd have had quite a lot of invites onto the British media, Craig.
Yeah, no, strangely enough, I haven't at all, because... And the line I would give is not the government line. I would say it seems very unlikely this is the Russians are doing this. And certainly they don't want to hear that all the other Soviet countries can make it too and that the Americans took away the equipment. You know, this is all information they're quite keen doesn't get to the British public. And it is actually quite frustrating that, you know, I sit here at home watching the television and I watch people built on as experts who have had a great deal less contact with it and know a great deal less about it than I do, whereas I'm excluded because what I say is not politically acceptable.
Well, here's one of them for you to have a listen to. It's Dr. Sally Leversley, and she was on Channel 4 News this week discussing it. So it'll be interesting to hear what she's got to say and then get your comments afterwards, Craig.
One of the forensic pathways can certainly be that it's been a hostile nation state, and we know that Britain has made a direct accusation to Russia, and that nation state needs to muddy the waters with lots of stories, lots of different counterpoint views, and to particularly take the international pressure off it for sanctions, if it can raise enough questions in international minds and remove the very tight support that there is for Britain over the Skripals case.
But that would suggest that scientifically it may be very, very difficult actually ever to conclude anything from this.
No, I think the scientists will be able to conclude because at the molecular level, they'll be able to see the level of decay. But the important thing is, internationally, has another team come in and done this particularly to protect the reputation of an international state, or has it been a supply chain issue where some medical waste has got into the park and been picked up and reused? We just don't know.
Thank you very, very much indeed for coming in, Dr. Sally Leversley. Thank you.
Sally Leversley there, and I'm also joined on the line by former ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, who's also, one might say, an expert in this field since he visited the place where the Novichok was tested in Uzbekistan. Now, what do you make of her analysis? What she's saying there, Craig, is that actually it is potentially traceable and linkable back to the previous Novichok attack, the same batch.
Yeah, they should indeed be able to check if it's from the same batch. That's certainly true. The only difficulty is there's no evidence at all that the last batch was made in Russia. So it'll be the same batch, but we don't know where it came from. And I must say, you know, for Dr. Sally Leversley, who's appearing on the media apparently in the guise of some kind of scientist, to then talk about well, a state might want to attack somebody else as well as a kind of false flag to protect its reputation. Nothing to do with science at all. She has no more idea what she's talking about when it comes to whether Russia would then decide to attack some more random people, so it looks like when it wasn't them. No, she's abusing her position. Being some kind of scientist doesn't make you an expert in international politics and espionage.
Okay, well, I'll tell you who is an expert, and that is the Prime Minister herself, Theresa May, and also Savid Javid, the Home Secretary, had something to say about this attack in Amesbury. I will let you have a final comment after we've heard from them, Craig.
The eyes of the world are currently on Russia, not least because of the World Cup. It is now time that the Russian state comes forward and explains exactly what has gone on. Let me be clear. We do not have a quarrel with the Russian people. Rather, it is the actions of the Russian government that continue to undermine our security and that of the international community. We will stand up to the actions that threaten our security and the security of our partners. It is completely unacceptable for our people to be either deliberate or accidental targets, or for our streets, our parks, our towns to be dumping grounds for poison.
Of course, my thoughts are with the people of Wiltshire, following the fact that we have seen two people this week again affected by this nerve agent. To see two more people exposed to the Novichok in the UK is obviously deeply disturbing, and the police, I know, will be leaving no stone unturned in their investigation in relation to what has happened.
So, Craig, what do you make of that? Also saying that the Russians are using Britain, Sahid Javid, as a dumping ground for poisons.
What I actually found most interesting was Javid was speaking in the Commons there, and when he got to his stirring a bit about the Russian state must come out, there were about four Tory MPs saying, he didn't get the sort of enthusiastic applause he was, not applause, but enthusiastic agreement he was expecting from the Commons, because frankly nobody really believes this.
Okay, what about the targeting in a way though, because obviously one can understand a former Russian spy, but these two people seem to be, you know, down on their luck, and possibly even addicts of hard drugs living in homeless hostels in Amesbury.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big worries about we don't know who did this. It could have been the Russians, it's certainly possible. But the Russians say it wasn't them, and for Javid to insist on the basis of no evidence whatsoever, no evidence has been adduced that it was the Russians, for Javid to insist that the Russian state admits to something it says it didn't do is a bit daft. One thing that does worry me is when you look at some of the other possibilities for whoever did this, including our own security services, including a rogue person from Porton Down. The elephant in the room is Porton Down. You know, you have one of the few places in the world that admits it does make chemical weapons, which is Porton Down, which makes them for testing purposes, and has certainly synthesized Novichok in the past. And 3 miles one side of it and 6 miles the other side of it, 4 months apart, to chemical weapons poisoning.
Craig Murray, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks very much for joining us, former ambassador to Uzbekistan. It's time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. Coming up live on Facebook, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our old Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summers. Also, Estella Ticknell in the first hour. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable St Paul's Carnival tomorrow weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we feature for the hour independent journalist Peter Byrne. In a series of articles over the past year, Peter Byrne has been looking at extremism. In one article from The New Scientist magazine, he asks about the anatomy of terror, what makes normal people become extremists. In another piece Peter Byrne published, on the origins of white nationalism. An hour with Peter Byrne on the Project Censored Show today. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we talk with independent journalist Peter Byrne. He's a Northern California-based award-winning investigative journalist and has an uncanny ability to mine reportable nuggets of graft and corruption out of mountains of government and corporate records. Peter Byrne's recent pieces included Busted, Breast Cancer, Money in the Media, also Going Postal, U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein's husband sells post offices to his friends. Cheap. Peter Byrne has won many awards over the years for his fantastic reporting, including one a few years ago from Project Censored. On today's program, we're going to talk about the anatomy of terror, what makes normal people become extremists. That will be the foreign element of our conversation, but we'll also bring it domestic by talking about the origins of white nationalism. Peter Byrne, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Hi, Mickey.
So, Peter Byrne, you've, as usual, been very busy writing about fascinating things, and today we're going to focus on a couple of articles that you did, one from summer of 2017 and another very recent, both in The New Scientist or newscientist.com. The one from August 2017, you know, you've been writing about this topic for a while. This is called Anatomy of Terror, or Roots of Terror, as it is in the print edition. What makes normal people become extremists? And then the tagline for this, to give listeners an idea where you're going, it takes more than religious fanaticism or hatred to make someone take innocent lives, but recognize the true roots of ISIS-inspired terror, and they can be addressed. What brought you into writing about this specific topic? And again, you have a background, too, as a science writer.
I was reading the New York Times, of all things, which I never subscribed to. I always use Tor so I can get it for free. And it was reporting on ISIS in Iraq and Syria. This is about 2.5, 3 years ago. And I noticed that the territory that ISIS was controlling tended to flow along the Tigris and Euphrates River and major roadways, which reminded me of a network. And in network science, you talk about how certain nodes are more powerfully connected than other nodes, for example, and they're connected by edges, which in this case would be the rivers and the roads. And I was thinking, well, since ISIS is obviously such a bunch of bad guys, why aren't we, like, cutting these edges and isolating them? And I didn't know the answer. So I remembered after 9/11, I had interviewed this man at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey about terrorist networks, a man named John Arquilla. And he had now risen up to be the chair of the Department of Defense Analyses, a really connected dude in the Pentagon and all that kind of stuff. So I went down to Monterey and spent a couple of days there talking to these people that teach special operations, people like SEALs and Rangers and Green Berets, how to hunt terrorists. And it turns out that they use complex adaptive systems theory to try and figure out what to do, which is basically, people maybe used to know it as chaos theory. It's the attempt to kind of find patterns in any kind of turbulent data stream so that you can make some kinds of predictions on it. And what these guys, who were really embedded inside the military, academic, industrial science complex, war of terror complex, were telling me was we totally messed up. The war on terror is an awful mistake. We shouldn't even be attacking ISIS. We should not be bombing Mosul. It's going to all turn bad. And they, of course, turned out to be correct. I mean, Mosul is completely destroyed. So I started looking at it from a science point of view. And what I discovered was that there's a whole range of sciences, from neurobiology and epidemiology and psychology and linguistics and physics and chemistry. Literally, almost every science you can think of, there's a terrorism focus somewhere in academia or in the private sector or in military-type organizations. And you don't read about this in the New York Times or anywhere, but inside this huge terrorism studies industry, which has just exponentially grown after 9/11, there's literally billions of dollars funneled into studying terrorism one way or another. you've got two kinds of focuses. You've got a kind of a linear focus, which is like, they're bad people, we should just go kill them, which reverberates back to creating more terrorists, of course, which is provable.
ISIS was not in Iraq prior to the invasion in 2003.
ISIS is a direct result of the destruction of the Iraqi socioeconomic infrastructure.
So this approach is create bad guys, get the bad guys, create more bad guys, and keep throwing money
at it. And it spends a lot of money. Like right now, Brown University's study shows that upwards of $6 trillion, which is bigger than the gross national product of the United States, has been spent on this war on terror, which is the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and all the counterterrorism so-called efforts that go with it, including drone strikes, and paying scientists and others to study the phenomena. So what happened to me was I began to see that there was all this scientific analytics around this. There wasn't much data because most of the data that is used for these studies, remarkably, tends to be drawn from English-only media sources. It turns out that most of the data, you know, you would think that we have this vast NSA satellite, you know, spying infrastructure, which we do, of course, but what that infrastructure is focused on is trying to find, quote-unquote, bad guys and kill them. There's no focus whatsoever inside that apparatus on looking at the root causes of what we call terrorism, which is actually really a tactic used by insurgency. There's no such thing as a terrorist. There's no such thing as a terrorist philosophy. It's not a strategy. It's a tactic that is used from time to time by people that are generally fighting foreign invasions and the repression of local civil rights.
That's a pretty significant definition that you're giving us here.
There are officially almost 150 definitions of terrorism in the academic lexicon, as it were, all of them pretty much invented by institutions that are devoted to fighting terrorism. My own personal definition is that it is violence directed against civilians for political purposes, which includes, of course, states. But probably 99.9% of the definitions in use deliberately exclude states and focus only on what they call non-state terrorism, as if it's a thing, when it's actually just an expedient tactic that is used from time to time by people that are generally fighting to redress what they perceive to be grievances, you know, and generally those grievances are real, even though in the academic lexicon they always qualify it by saying perceived grievance. Because, you know, nobody really wants to solve this issue of the exponential growth of terrorism since 9/11. So back to the database situation, you've got all these people who are analyzing incident rate data, numbers of attacks based on English-only media reports. They don't check out the Russian media or the Arab press or anything that's not in English. And they build these databases and they confuse insurgent actions with terrorist-type attacks. And they have no database for counterterrorism. There is no database about the numbers of terroristic attacks on civilian populations mounted by the United States and its so-called coalition in Iraq and Afghanistan, Somalia, and about 60 countries around the world where we have special operations forces now working.
In fact, you quote Martha Crenshaw in your article, Roots of Terror. Crenshaw says, we don't even know what success might look like in this war on terror. And she likens it to a game of whack-a-mole.
Yeah, she says they pop up, we hit them on the head, and then we wait for the next one to pop up. But what I found was I talked to people like Wayne Porter, who used to be the chief of naval intelligence for the Middle East and then was the science advisor to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who's really into complexity theory type analyses. And he was saying that if we don't address the root causes of terrorism, we're going to end up not only bankrupting the United States economy, but we're going to annihilate our democratic values, such as they are. And I was being told time and time again that the official line that ISIS is evil and we must root them out is 180 degrees wrong, that actually we'd be much better off, and this was actually, I think, proven by what happened in Mosul and Raqqa, leaving a group like ISIS to evolve on its own. These horrible beheading public relations stunts that they pulled, evil as they are, were not their mode of operation. Public opinion polls actually showed that before and after ISIS was in charge of Mosul, they were popular in large segments of the population. In fact, they didn't seize Mosul in a day. It was over years. They built up a kind of presence, and then one day the Iraqi army ran away and they took over. So at any rate, as a journalist, I decided that if I was going to write about this, I needed to go talk to some people that were in the field and asked my new friends in the military how I could get to Mosul. The military itself was not allowing reporters to embed anymore. Not that I wanted to embed, but I wanted to not get killed either. And I figured walking around Mosul without an armed guard handy was probably like suicide, and I'm not into that. But what I did do was I found a young behavioral economist out of Harvard named Vera Mironova, who happens to be a Russian-American. And she was embedded with Iraqi special forces in Mosul, the so-called Golden Division, which was leading the fight against ISIS in Mosul. So I went to northern Iraq, to Kurdistan. I flew into Erbil and met up with Vera. And we drove to Mosul in January 2017 through numerous checkpoints, which she just flashed some pieces of paper she had from the Iraqi military, and they let her through. And we ended up arriving in Mosul right as the Prime Minister of Iraq was declaring that eastern Mosul was liberated from ISIS, east of the Tigris River, as it were. The west was the old city, which took another year for ISIS to be driven out of, mostly by pulverizing the city and tens of thousands of civilians that live there. So I hung out with Vera and these Iraqi soldiers in their Humvee and with their guns, and most of them didn't speak English. So I had my smartphone, so-called, and used Google Translate, and we had some pretty hilarious conversations. And we had some pretty hilarious meals. At one point, they asked me if I would like to have pacha for breakfast. And we went to this restaurant in Mosul, which was about the only one open at that point. And they all ordered pizzas, and they ordered me a pacha, which happens to have been sheep brains and intestines stuffed with God knows what. And it was a very unappetizing, although probably a McDonald's would be equally unappetizing to an Iraqi point of view. And I ate it, and all these guys were staring at me. They were kind of disappointed. They said, oh, you must be special forces. It actually wasn't that bad. It was kind of tasty. The intestines were actually stuffed with rice. So about 2 days later, that suicide bomber went in there and blew up the whole restaurant. But hanging out with Vera, we would go into ISIS houses that had been recently abandoned, or the ISIS cadre were either dead or captured. And the soldiers would look for intelligence material, you know, phone numbers, things like that, because they want to be able to track more people down and kill them. Vera was looking for anthropological stuff. You know, we were gathering up food wrappers. Turns out that ISIS likes Johnny Walker Red a whole lot, and they smoke Marlboros. And we also found diaries that Russian women who had married ISIS fighters had kept that were actually quite moving. And one of them in particular, this woman had written a letter to her husband who was in the ISIS front line talking about how they were going to meet in heaven after they were martyred. And then she scrawled the recipe of a type of cake that can only be made with a special kind of milk that you can get in Russia, and was hoping that she could find some in embattled Mosul. You know, it's a terrorist dream of comfort food, too, as turns out. At any rate, all sorts of interesting anthropological stuff was gathered. And after that, I left and got back into the United States just in time to see all the demonstrators at San Francisco International Airport protesting Trump telling the Iraqis that they could no longer come here, and, you know, the Muslim countries were banned from America and stuff like that. Actually, that started when I was in the refugee camps interviewing people outside of Mosul, and they were really, like, horrified that we would destroy their country and then tell them they couldn't come here to escape.
And there'd already been 5+ million refugees coming out of Iraq.
Yeah, and it was like close to 1 million coming out of the Mosul area. They're still living in these horrible refugee camps, you know, partially run by the UN, partially run by the family that owns Kurdistan. And a lot of them can't go back to Mosul. One family that I interviewed in particular, ISIS had come to their house and they said, we're going to live in your house. You can live on the top floor. We're going to live in the bottom floor. And the guy was a welder. You have to weld stuff for us, like prison bars and things like that. Metal plate for suicide vehicles. And the guy did. He had 3 young kids, right? Which didn't mean that he was ideologically in tune with them. But during the battle, he managed to escape and they ended up in this camp. To my knowledge, he's still there. But they can't go back, because his neighbors think that he's an ISIS person. And when people think you're an ISIS person in those types of circumstances, generally some kind of vigilante terrorism is executed upon you. So I wrote this article, The Roots of Terror, The Anatomy of Terror, for New Scientist. New Scientist actually sent me to Mosul to do this. They're a wonderful organization based in the United Kingdom, and they have an American staff as well.
Paying you to do actual investigative journalism on the ground where there are no other reporters.
No. Actually, no, there were corporate media. I ran into some New York Times photographers and people like that. They tended to be freelancers and stringers. There was some people from the mainstream media that were doing some pretty good stuff. In fact, I had my little video camera with me, and I sold a bunch of clips to Fox News, of all people.
No, I remember that Fox News was one of the places that had published something. Others didn't bite.
It's funny because Erbil is actually full of all sorts of freelance journalists, you know, and the trick is to get to the front line. So I happened to be in a great position because Vera was so thoroughly embedded and had all these documents that we could get through all these checkpoints. But a lot of reporters, you know, were little freelancers that were selling their wares for pittances to, right, you know, CNN or whatever, were just flocking around dead bodies trying to get the same story, you know. But nobody at all was looking at the context and at the roots of terror. As far as I know, you know, if you look at stuff that was coming out in the New York Times or the New Yorker, you know, they love to talk about ISIS people throwing gay guys off of towers and head chopping and evil this and evil that. But nobody talks about why they're doing it. You know, the New Yorker had this like 20-page article on atrocities, but no context whatsoever. So that's my goal, is to provide context. And in this particular case, you provide context by gathering data that actually is true, and then you analyze it, and you can use science to analyze it.
We're speaking with investigative journalist Peter Byrne. We're talking about an article that was published last year in New Scientist. It's at newscientist.com. The article is called Roots of Terror, and we will continue that conversation with Peter Byrne after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. We're joined today by award-winning investigative journalist Peter Byrne. We're talking about an article he did last year called Roots of Terror. In a little while, we're going to talk about a more recent article that you did and sort of connect things abroad with some of the things maybe happening here domestically. But let's cut to the chase here, literally. What are the roots of the terror that you saw when you were there? So what is it that the corporate media were missing?
I talked to any number of people in Erbil, which is a sister city to Mosul, which was not captured by ISIS, and they would tell me, we were happier under Saddam Hussein. You came in and you completely destroyed our country and turned it into a wasteland, and our economy is tanked, and we can't even sell oil anymore because your companies came in here and took all these production sharing contracts, which were unfair. So the roots are socioeconomic. The military types that actually do look at root causes will tell you time and time again that the major cause is people fighting insurgencies against in a foreign invasion, and people reacting to the repression of civil rights at a local level. It's local, local, local. So when the United States went in there and installed a Shiite government to take over from the previous Sunni-oriented regime of Saddam Hussein, the Shiites started to exterminate Sunnis. And to make a long story short, they fought back, and ISIS had gradually emerged from that and completely liquidated the idea of national boundaries that had been instituted after World War I by the Sykes-Picot Agreement and moved into Syria, you know, saying that we're having a caliphate. We're not going to abide by these kind of imperialist mandated boundaries anymore. And that excited a lot of people, not just in the region, but obviously in Europe and even in America, where something upwards of 40,000 foreign fighters came there. A lot of the foreign fighters were ideologically driven. I think that a lot of the people in Iraq and Syria that ended up joining not just ISIS but al-Nusra and a bunch of other insurgent groups with Islamist bent were more looking to have regular incomes, even if it was loot, and to escape enemies, you know. And if you're a Sunni and you're being pursued by the Shia, you want to join a gang, right? There's another element, too. I mean, Martha Crenshaw, who I talked to, is kind of the first person to really study terrorism starting back in the 70s from a scientific point of view. And she's famous for saying that terrorists are rational actors, which was a break with the previous conception, which was that all terrorists are psychopaths.
Yeah, crazy people.
She was saying that they actually have valid socioeconomic grievances, even if you don't agree with their methods of addressing them, which, you know, it's pretty hard to agree with somebody blowing up a bunch of school kids. But the United States does that with bombs all the time anyway, right? So what's the difference? Actually, I found something that went beyond Crenshaw's analysis, which is it was good at the time. But the more that the phenomena is studied, the more we see from a psychological point of view that even though the organizations themselves might be rational actors, they might be launching terrorist attacks against point X or point Y or this mosque or that army unit or that police station for tactical purposes in an insurgency, and that's rational kind of military thinking, that people that actually blow themselves up or that go and mass murder, you know, people with bombs and automatic weapons or even trucks are not like really normal. Give me a break. Killing people isn't like really the same thing to do, you know, right. Whether you're a terrorist or a counter-terrorist or a Navy SEAL or an ISIS member, you know. So I began to think, you know, what is it really going on here psychologically? Now, the thing with the Islamist variety of insurgent slash terrorists is that the kind of interviews that have been done with them generally have been after they've been captured, which they have very often a political point of view that they want to put across. They're not exactly going to tell you the truth. There's some cultural prohibitions against asking them about their childhoods and things like that. But as I was told by some very astute British researchers, the more that you talk to people that have blown up civilians, the more you find that they did it because they were really distressed that their own family had been blown up by the Americans or by the Shia. Now, is that a rational thing to do? Your family was blown up, so you go blow up somebody else's family? You know, not necessarily. So what makes a quote-unquote terrorist tick is the question. And here's the thing. You can strive to make a profile of a typical terrorist, so-called, but you can't. And people have been trying to do that for decades now, and they can't. Because all of the various qualities that you might say would drive a terrorist, socioeconomic grievances, perhaps not mental illness, but some kind of mental distress because of childhood sexual abuse or whatever, a lot of people that have those particular configurations don't commit terrorist acts. So why does a person that has the same kinds of characteristics that millions of other people have commit a terrorist act? It's all about context. They do it in a certain environment. There's a confluence of socioeconomic, environmental conditions with a personality that is predisposed in some way because of what's happened in their life and it has happened politically around them to respond by killing innocent people.
So, Peter Byrne, another element here of this in terms of the way that the United States and other states have been dealing with terrorism, you know, we mentioned the whack-a-mole quote earlier. We mentioned the idea of creating terrorists and killing terrorists. But one of the offshoots of this, too, is to purportedly disrupt the networks, disrupt the terrorist networks. And one of the ways that we've seen that going on is by trying to shut down parts of the Internet or censorship or combat misuse of the Internet in ways that proliferate extremism. So that's that language, extremism, has been used. And here, Cass Sunstein in the United States under Obama, you know, looked into that. There are many other groups in the U.S. that are looking into this extremist rhetoric, and they're trying to close down sectors of the Internet. So what can you say about this?
Well, they're never really going to close it down because the Internet is like the primary lens by which the intelligence agencies find people to target with stings and make a big PR stink about. They've stopped terrorists in their tracks when generally they've approached people that otherwise wouldn't have done anything and given them the opportunity to sound off and then arrested them for basically not actually doing anything. On the other hand, there's a ton of data showing that most people are driven to join groups that engage in terrorism by friends and family. It's a camaraderie thing. You join a group that's engaged in violent extremism of various sorts, generally in the beginning, for safety or for companionship in a stressed out situation, which you might find in Iraq. Which brings us to the question of white nationalism.
There's another article that we want to get to here. So you just brought up white nationalism. This other article you did, Roots of Terror, was published last year. And now just in June 2018, you have another article here That's at newscientist.com. On the origins of white nationalism, what motivates far-right extremism? Sociological studies are giving new insights and ways to tackle the phenomenon. And Peter Byrne, you then go and write about this. So coming from your experience in Iraq, how did that inform you, or did it at all, in terms of what you found here in particular extremist movements in the U.S.?
Well, what I was interested in was the psychology of people that are driven by socioeconomic and political circumstances to engage in, you know, violent extremism against otherwise innocent people, you know, civilians. And most of the jihadist types that are interviewed about those types of issues are in prison, and their interviews are biased in that regard. And you don't really, because of cultural phenomena, get into questions of, say, sexual childhood abuse and substance abuse and things like that. So I convinced New Scientist to send me to Orange County to interview former terrorists, Los Angeles Hammerskin types, Christian Identity people, people that in the 90s and mid the early aughts had actually engaged in viciously beating and sometimes murdering black people and Latinos and Mexicans and gay people. And in the epicenter of neo-Nazism and white supremacy that emerged in Orange County in the 70s as the previously purely pristine white suburbs were infiltrated by blacks and Asians. And I hooked up with a scientist at Chapman University named Pete Simme, who has probably done the most comprehensive analytics on the origins of white nationalist, neo-Nazi, violent extremism of anybody. He actually wrote a book called American Swastika that came out a couple years ago, based on his embedding with a bunch of neo-Nazis in Orange County and elsewhere, to the extent that he would go to their parties celebrating Adolf Hitler, and he'd be in their houses when they had, for Christmas, they would have a swastika on the Christmas tree instead of a star. Their kids would have, like, coloring books, black people being lynched. They would look like otherwise normal suburban families, but they had this kind of culture going on, this safe space. And he also interviewed in a very scientific way, took the life histories of several hundred former white supremacist neo-Nazi types that had abjured their former violent ways, as well as people that were also active. And what he found was that probably 80% of the people he interviewed had sexual abuse and physical abuse growing up as children. They came from broken homes. They came from parents that had substance abuse problems. They themselves had substance abuse problems. So by the time they were in their teens, which is generally when people join up with skinheads and neo-Nazi type groups, they were already predisposed to act out their psychological predilections violently. And they would hook up with groups that gave them a sense of comradeship, and that also provided safety, because when you're living on the streets and you're going around randomly kicking people and worse, they join a skinhead group, for example, and then they become ideologically inculcated with the tenets of white supremacy. And time again, people who have studied white supremacists and neo-Nazi types in the United States are finding the same thing, that these are psychologically really damaged people. They're not necessarily psychotic. They're not like narcissists like, say, our president or Ted Bundy types. But they're people that have some serious issues, you know, personality disorders, that tend to flock together in these groups and then act out these problems that they had generally stemming from their childhood.
You talk in the article, too, about sociological research on extremists, and you mentioned that it's kind of difficult to really study what goes on in some of these groups. What do you do? Do you put out an ad and say, hey, we want to talk to some Nazis? Or
no, it's the kind of what they call a snowball effect. Mm-hmm. You find one person and they lead you to a series of other people, which is, from a scientific point of view, it's a little bit problematic because mm-hmm. you're supposed to have a randomized study, and it's not random.
It's not random at all, actually. Yeah, right. But this is how you're getting insights from people that are part of this.
It's the only way to do it. You know, you can't advertise right. for violent extremists, Nazi lovers, and they're not going to flock around. So you also have to get permissions from your institutional review boards
right.
and your universities, which means that you're not going to cause harm to your subjects that you're interviewing. And Vera in Iraq had that imprimatur, mm-hmm. and Pete Simme in Southern California also had that approval, and he didn't. A lot of it's anonymized, and the data is not used for, you know, intelligence or law enforcement purposes. It's used purely to find out what makes people tick.
And so in your estimation, you know, again, you wrote about the Charlottesville 2017 events and a whole slew of people that were talked to. What did you come away with, or what do you see any similarities, differences between what you were seeing when you were looking at people in ISIS?
There's a lot of similarities. I look at it as two kinds of spectrums. If you have a spectrum of, say, psychosis to normality. So if you have a spectrum of mental health, and then you have a spectrum of grievances, from the grievances of, say, a white supremacist who thinks that knocking down Confederate monuments is a Jewish plot, to the grievance of, say, somebody in Iraq who's family was bombed by the United States and whose business was destroyed by the opposite religious ideology, you know, that's a real grievance. So you've got a not very real grievance, and you've got a real grievance. And then you've got not too crazy, and then you've got really crazy. I think it's kind of an inverse relationship. The more crazy you are, the more likely you are to believe a not really true grievance. The less crazy that you are, the more logical and rational you are. You're going to believe one that's really true, like I'm being bombed and my entire country's being destroyed. How can I fight back?
Empirical evidence.
And terrorism is a weapon of people that don't have F-16s and atom bombs and things like
powerless,
that. Because it's a political thing. Mm-hmm. You want to terrorize your enemies so that they stop terrorizing you. And interesting, what was found out in the Twitter stream around 2014 in the territory that ISIS seized in Iraq and Syria was that before the United States started bombing ISIS in 2014, the Twitter enemy was identified as the near enemy. It was the imam down the road or the shopkeeper that was not bowing to Mecca often enough. But the minute that the bomb started to drop, the far enemy came into play, and that was the chatter about bombing people in Paris and in the United States and Brussels and things like that. So the exporting of ISIS terror to the West was a direct result, data-driven and provable result of the United States bombing Mosul and Raqqa and the Syria.
So coming back here to the United States then, and on your studying of the white nationalist movements, and the state that that's in now, and again, it seems as if in the Trump presidency that, you know, sort of the mask has kind of come off of this, and we've seen more of this. Again, this is not new in our history per se, but we've certainly seen more visibly white nationalist movements, these kind of movements that are very intolerant. What is your idea, based on your research, how do you tackle that phenomenon? How do you get to the roots of this?
I think it's actually easier than the other phenomena, the jihadist phenomena, and I will refer to the ethnographer and sociologist Catherine Blee at the University of Pittsburgh, who I interviewed for this article in New Scientist about white nationalism. Blee actually has embedded with white nationalist neo-Nazi women over the decades. When we talked about the roots of white nationalism, she stated very clearly that it was racism in America. In our society, racism is embedded into the society. It's embedded into the culture. It's been here for hundreds of years. As the Trump phenomenon show, it didn't really go away after the civil rights movement. It was just waiting to pounce. And it's metastasizing now. So if you have in your culture a kind of racist status quo, even unconscious racism, if a bell curve of racism in America has a mean value, then on the tails of the curve, on the out, you're going to have outliers who are going to be violent, perhaps terroristic. So her suggestion is, if we want to get to the roots and solve the question of white nationalism and violent extremism, including Christian identity, anti-abortion clinic attacks and things like that, murders, then we have to adjust our thinking in our own culture. We have to actually develop and evolve a society and a culture in which racism is not acceptable, and then the outliers will gradually go away, and it should be treated as a criminal problem, which also, in my opinion, applies to the question of international jihadist terrorism. That is a criminal problem, not a problem that requires an entire Western society to mobilize a multi-trillion dollar war based on fear and the profits
of Lockheed Martin.
Yeah, and would you argue that education is some way that it's possible to get? I mean, look, we've had education for ages. We've gradually, certainly in the last 50 years, had education about race, about structural racism, sexism. And in fact, we have whole movements basically come out of this to try to address, to do what you said, to try to, when people are committing crimes, they're committing crime.
There's something else, Mickey, that ties it all together besides the psychological aspect. Now, this ties together white nationalism, neo-Nazi type thinking, Christian identity type thinking with Islamist, jihadist types of movements. And that is neoliberal globalization. It's inequality driven. Poverty is well known not to be a driver of insurgency and terrorism. It's inequality and repression that are the drivers. So in the United States, there is a tremendous amount of economic and social inequality, and that is driving the racist movement. In the Middle East and Indonesia, where you have Islamist insurgent terrorist types of organizations and movements, it is also driven by the inequalities between the ruling elites and the masses of the people. Because people that engage in political terrorism and insurgency, they're not actually, from their own points of view, doing it because they just want to blow up people. They consider themselves to be altruists, and in many ways they are. They are speaking for masses of people through a lens that can only be appreciated if you're there on the ground. And I have to add that from white nationalist terrorist types of organizations to jihadist type terrorist organizations, none of them act without mass bases. They have to have mass bases. There are people, millions of people, that support these movements because they are the only political antidote to the depredations of neoliberal globalization, which is coming in, extracting resources through military force and the brutality of capitalist exploitation.
And in these two articles, you're getting at, this is something that is going on abroad, but it's also happening here, of course, domestically.
It's global. That's why they call it globalization. And, you know, globalization, you know, ever since the meltdown of 2008, it's gotten stronger and stronger and stronger with the gap between the haves and the have-nots, as we've seen in this country, which is basically run by Goldman Sachs, right? So it's not like totally out of line that your person on the streets who's got some issues is going to be attracted to the idea that Jews are running the world and that therefore we should kill them all, or that the blacks are trying to muddy up our otherwise pristine race. We saw this happen in Hitler's Germany. We're seeing it happen now in Eastern Europe, in Poland and elsewhere, in Germany itself and in England. You know, there's a tremendous resurgence of this weird mix of plutocracy and populism that Trump embodies, which the new leader of Italy embodies, where the immigrants that are being expelled as refugees from the war on terror's horrors in the Middle East are being turned away from Western countries and told to go drown. There's no recognition that the people that are boat people in the Mediterranean are there because of the war on terror.
Chase Palmieri here.
Peter, I have a question for you. I'm wondering how much of this is a generational thing. If enough time passes, that the problem of white nationalism will fade into the history books, or are there young people today who are grasping at these ideologies?
Oh, you've seen the alt-right. I mean, those people were all pretty much young. There's a pool of disaffected white youth that's always been drawn on for decades by these types of organizations, and I see no evidence that that's going away. I think it's getting stronger. And if you look at, like, say, White Rabbit Radio, there's a tremendous amount of online materials, including like the six-hour movie of Adolf Hitler, which is like the true story of Adolf Hitler, painting him as a pretty nice guy. There's a huge, easily accessible body of validation that you're okay as a white person, and it is targeting the youth. In fact, there's a lot of similarities between jihadist type propaganda in music, Islamist rap and music videos, with what is coming out of the white supremacist movement. I mean, you had bands back in the 90s like Skinhead. White power rock was a huge draw for the youth, and that's actually not maybe as strong right now as the little vortices and pathways of racist kind of attacks on multiculturalism that aren't quite as pointed as, you know, skinhead might have been, but which are targeting this notion that there's no reason that our race should be diminished, giving people affirmative action, which is taking away from us as if it was a zero-sum game.
Well, you see this with Richard Spencer. You see this with a lot of the neo-Nazi types claiming they're not Nazis, claiming that they're even not racist.
No, they're for freedom of speech.
Right. So it's a very strange and Orwellian twist. What do you think, then, is to be done about this issue here in the United States?
I'll start with the issue of jihadist insurgency and terrorism. That very clearly can be ameliorated and allowed to devolve and probably go away over a period of time if we stop attacking people's countries and taking their stuff. If we turn neoliberal globalization based on austerity and harming people into something that was more positive, like maybe a socialist type approach, which, you know, actually on paper looks pretty good. And here we need to have a society in which the president of the United States is not allowed to broadcast in the media the kind of racist tripe that this man has been promoting every day for 3 years now. That is CNN and the New York Times and the people that amplify his vile tweets are responsible for creating this culture in which you're going to find people that are willing to pick up bombs and guns to kill what they call MUDs.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. After this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation with Peter Byrne, and we'll also bring his son into the conversation, Miles Byrne, as he accompanied his father to a recent conference on terrorism and counterterrorism. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with co-host Chase Palmieri. On today's show, we've been speaking with Peter Byrne. He is a Northern California-based award-winning investigative journalist. A few of his recent exposés include Busted, Breast Cancer, Money in the Media, as well as Going Postal, U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein's husband sells post offices to his friends. Cheap. On this program, we've been focusing on Peter Byrne's more recent work published at NewScientist.com. And New Scientist magazine. One is Anatomy of Terror, What Makes Normal People Become Extremists. And Peter Byrne, of course, says, well, it takes more than religious fanaticism or hatred to make someone take innocent lives. But recognize the true roots of ISIS-inspired terror, and they can be addressed. We're also speaking with him about his article on the origins of white nationalism. Peter Byrne, before the break, you were going back and forth, in fact, between war on terrorism abroad as well as what we're seeing in terms of extremism at home. And we did start making mention of what role the media play in the portrayal of these groups. So I figured, given the Project Censored Show, we often talk about media and media analysis. And, of course, you've done your own fair share of media criticism as a journalist. What are your thoughts on the issue of media and how these topics are being both presented and how you think maybe the media is not doing these topics justice?
Well, the so-called war on terror, the long war, is obviously a profit center for the major mainstream media. Not only does terrorism ISIS style with beheadings or Timothy McVeigh style with blowing up federal buildings increase ratings greatly when they occur, so people can sell. So they generate mass feelings of fear and anxiety, which is why terrorism works. And so even though the risk of actually being killed by a so-called terrorist is almost vanishingly small, we see our group threatened, so it works. And the media knows that. What is largely missing from the media reports on the so-called war on terrorism, which is a global war over the last 18 years, has been any voice of dissent from the scientific community, which is what I report upon in both of my New Scientist articles and in an upcoming book. The scientists originally, and I've interviewed hundreds of them, many of them were mobilized by the events of 9/11 to start using their science, whether it was neurobiology or psychology or physics or, you know, easily 20 or so disciplines, even including philosophy, to take a look at terrorism and what it is and what it is not and what works or doesn't work to ameliorate it. And what I found is that not only are scientists that are embedded within the military-industrial complex structure and in academia increasingly coming to the conclusion that the war on terror is the cause of terrorism, but people inside the military, advisors to joint chiefs of staff, captains and colonels in the intelligence community, former Navy SEALs that are engaged in counterterrorism activities in Iraq and Afghanistan, have been telling me over and over and over again that every time we go and kill people in villages or with drones or ruin someone's economy, which is what these wars have been doing, or steal their resources, which is what these wars have been doing because they are wars, we create new generations of terrorists to replace the people that we kill because we kill their fathers and their own.
Interesting, Peter Byrne, that Noam Chomsky, in the many books he's written on the issue of terrorism, and especially since 9/11, he's basically said, in his estimation, the best way to decrease terrorism or to help eradicate the problem of terrorism is to simply stop participating in it.
Absolutely, and I would concur, and I think that the interesting thing about my research is that now a huge proportion of people that study terrorism from a scientific basis or from the point of view of political science would also concur with him. Now, they may not want to say the words Noam Chomsky.
Yeah, right.
But they're saying the same things. And I found that even inside the Pentagon, I heard high-ranking people that study this in great detail saying the same things because they're fed up with the bloodbath and with the loss of what they call treasure. So when you look at the grievances of people in Iraq and Afghanistan, they always go back to the fact that we attacked their countries and destroyed their countries. You hear time and time again now at the highest levels of American government, well, we can't allow Iraq to break up into three separate nations. It's got to be one nation. Well, it was one nation when we attacked it. Regarding the Taliban, they say we can't leave Afghanistan because then the Taliban will win. Well, they're winning. It's been 17 years. So it's not rational that we keep doing this. Now, in an attempt to kind of unravel what's rational and what's not rational, I recently got a grant to organize a conference at UC Davis with Jim Crutchfield, who's a very renowned statistical physicist and complexity theorist. He's kind of legendary. And we gathered a bunch of scientists together for one day and had everybody make small presentations, and then we had a lot of talking back and forth on how can we define this problem of the relationship of counterterrorism to terrorism, where counterterrorism causes terrorism and terrorism causes feedback loop to cause counterterrorism. It's this kind of self-replicating loop. How do we interfere with that? And the point is that a lot of people that have the analysis that counterterrorism causes terrorism have no traction inside the White House or at the upper levels of the Pentagon or in Congress, which is run by the military-industrial Lockheed Martin, et cetera, complex. So the result of this conference, and these people, some of them have worked for years with the Pentagon, is that we can no longer do that sort of top-down organizing. We have to start doing a bottom-up type of organizing and getting out the word to normal people through whatever means that we can that counterterrorism causes terrorism. And then if we want to understand and stop terrorism, we have to first look in the mirror. And then we have to do things that may be seemingly distasteful, but in the long run would solve all sorts of problems, which is rethink and stop the kind of neoliberal austerity program, country-destroying globalism, so-called globalism that we've been exporting ever since Ronald Reagan. Rethink going in and stealing people's resources and using military force to annihilate entire cultures in a war which, you know, really is in many ways, like it or not, a war against the Muslim world, because all the countries that we attack happen to be pretty much Muslim, and that's how they view it. So we need to actually be honest and start taking a look at this and deciding, you know, what's in our real interest if we want to continue to have the occasional terroristic attack in New York and the daily terrorist attacks in countries that we've occupied, then we're going to have to stop the type of imperialist economics and militarization that we're doing that is actually also ruining the American economy.
Peter, this is Chase Palmieri. You just mentioned how the U.S. government keeps moving the goalposts in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm wondering, since you've been in Mosul and you've been abroad there, what is the best argument you've heard in favor for why the U.S. should still be in both of those countries?
I've not heard a good argument for that. There is no good argument for that. I mean, when I talk to ordinary people in Kurdistan and Erbil and Mosul, they were saying, you know, we were better off under Saddam Hussein. We hated him, but we were better off. Why don't you guys just leave? You know, there's the question that's always held out. Well, maybe the World Bank and the IMF can invest in the buildings that we just blew up and you can have new ones. Well, that doesn't go very far. Just ask people in Bosnia or Panama City. I mean, who wants the foreigners to own everything? And that's essentially what has happened in Iraq. Foreign capital, especially the oil companies, have made a lot of headway. They haven't been able to grasp everything that they wanted. They ran into difficulties because the Russians also came in and stepped into some gaps, and so did the Chinese. And they've been making pretty significant fossil fuel types of deals with disaffected Kurds and other factions. So actually, I think that, you know, the pottery barn thesis that Colin Powell so famously made before they invaded Iraq and Afghanistan and destroyed these vibrant, beautiful cultures, which if you broke it, we got to fix it. Well, actually, that's an insane formulation. If it's broken and you broke it, you can't fix it. The best thing you could do is to dump about $90 trillion on the table and walk away and say, I'm sorry, I'll never come back. Well, I'm going to go home and think about what I did and apologize and try to educate my populace not to do such terrible things in the future, which there may be a lot of people in America that would like to do that. So the question is, how do we reach them? They need information. And that information, from my kind of crusade, if you will, in regard to this, is to use information that comes out of the inside of the system by hard-nosed scientists and military specialists, including some Navy SEALs that were embedded in the high parts of the counterintelligence circles, is to just walk away from it. Just stop. Nobody has ever really thought that ISIS, for example, or the Taliban were an existential threat to the United States. Those people can't destroy the United States. But we can destroy the United States by trying to continually destroy them.
Indeed, Peter Byrne, that's what Chalmers Johnson said in the Blowback trilogy. That's, again, what Noam Chomsky's been saying for years. Interesting allies, however, that you're talking about many people that are expert within the system that are part of the military-industrial complex or the national security complex, and you're saying intellectually that their arguments appear to mirror those on the left.
At the UC Davis conference, we had two retired Navy SEALs, one of whom was in charge of science at the National Counterterrorism Center until he recently retired, and another does consulting in the private sector on these issues. These guys spent a number of years after the invasions leading SEAL teams in to annihilate people in villages. They have blood on their hands. And they told me that it didn't work, that every time we killed somebody, we created 10 people that hated us. So now they're actually, both of them have some scientific backgrounds, very keen on using complex adaptive system theory to model this so that we can show, not just mathematically, but logically, and in language people can understand, that every time that we do what it is that we've been doing for the last 17 years, which is a definition of insanity, of course, we're making the problem even worse. And we have to radically rethink what we're doing.
So if you're saying that counterterrorism abroad leads to more terrorists, does that mean that the U.S. shouldn't try to do any counterterrorism to the white supremacists within our own country because it would lead to more white supremacy?
No, I think that the solution path there is a bit different. As I mentioned earlier in the program, the violent extremism of the far right, you know, if you look at it like in a bell curve there on the outliers, it's going to be there as long as there's a medium of racism in the culture, which there is in America and always has been. As long as there is kind of this unconscious and conscious racism embedded in our culture, which is now getting, you know, more and more attention because it's being the fascists in the White House likes it, you're going to have those kind of people on the outliers. So it doesn't do much good to attack them because that just makes them stronger. And that's another lesson of counterterrorism in Iraq, Afghanistan, and in America. When you attack them, it makes them more resilient, which is because it's easier for them to disperse and reorganize and survive to fight another day, whereas a big lumbering, you know, Goliath can't do that. So if you want to reduce far-right terrorism in America, you have to not only reduce the cultural racism that is the foundation of our culture, but the same thing about neoliberal globalization applies. We need to completely reverse our imperialistic global projects and start reinventing our system of government and economics. Imperialist capitalism doesn't work. It's led us to this. It has clearly failed. We are a failed state here in the United States. So let's look for something different. Now, you know, people say, well, there isn't anything different. Look at communism and socialism. They failed everywhere they've been tried. And, you know, the answer to that is, yeah, they failed because capitalism came back, you know. I mean, anarchistic type programs have gone some distance too, but capitalism came back. So let's acknowledge those failures and not get caught up in a lot of metaphor baiting around that, but think logically about what it would mean to take profit out of the command of the American economy and put it on a basis where everybody can have a job, everybody can have a place to live, everybody can have an education, everybody can have access to health care. What would that look like? And of course we could do it. Hunter-gatherers were doing this 10,000 years ago. We've slid down since then, unfortunately.
We're speaking with independent journalist Peter Byrne. You can learn more about Peter Byrne's work at peterbyrne.info. That's B-Y-R-N-E. We've been talking about two of the articles that Peter published at thenewscientist.com online. You can see them. Anatomy of Terror, What Makes Normal People Become Extremists, is one from August of 2017. You can also see one from June this year. It is called On the Origins of White Nationalism. So it's also the case, Peter Byrne, that the conference that you were doing at UC Davis, you brought your son, Miles Byrne, who's 15 years old. Miles Byrne, you're here in the studio with us today, and I'm very curious to learn, what did you think of the interactions that were going there? What did you learn when you were at the conference?
The conference consisted of people from all sorts of academic disciplines, from sociology, from history, from the math department, from physics, and they pretty much were unanimously in agreement that the solution to terrorism, insofar as you know, the various disciplines could tell, was to not be present where it was happening, was to not exacerbate, you know, the wound that they had already caused. And the Navy SEAL guys, who were the people that were, you know, embedded in the counterterrorism industry, which is absolutely massive, had spent long enough floundering out there and had returned back saying that they realized that they were not getting anywhere with what they were doing. They had no clear objective. They did not have strategy. They were simply pouring military might into a place where military might had done nothing to reduce the damage that the people who had been radicalized were causing. And whenever you have someone who's growing up in a society that has been torn apart by an extraneous or exterior influence, it's like, you know, the young people there, they don't know how to respond to this, right? I mean, the political, moral, and emotional infrastructure has been just totally altered. You know, it's never been able to settle down and reach a solid point. So there's no comforting society that they can grow up around.
Well, Miles, as being a young person yourself, do you talk with people in your peer groups, you know, about these things, about these experiences? Do you talk about these kind of topics and subjects? And equally talk about them in the way that you just expressed, right? You were talking about what would it be like for young people to be growing up in these war-torn places. I mean, is this something that you talk to people here in the U.S. about?
Occasionally, not as much as I would like to. I think that there's a great deal of misinformation regarding terrorism. The media, which is a huge player, as you guys have mentioned again and again, and, you know, if they can get you asking the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about the answers.
They're good at that.
Yeah, that's their job.
Framing. Thank you very much for coming on the program today, Miles.
Thank you.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. The program was established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I'm also the executive producer of the program. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producers include Dennis Murphy and Mitch Scorza. To learn more about the Project Censored Show, go to projectcensored.org. The Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. All the programs are archived online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook and other social media. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Yanis Varoufakis. Is Capitalism Devouring Democracy? The two June 2018 programs by TUC Radio. with the economist and renegade former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis, drew such a huge response that we are following up with an extraordinary excerpt from a May 9, 2018 talk at the Cambridge Forum. In that talk, Yanis Varoufakis makes the point that democracy and capitalism are incompatible. However, capitalism also can't maintain itself, he says. It is a self-devouring system. And with great urgency, he invites us today to resolve the question of who is going to survive, democracy or the global financial system. In this excerpt of his near two-hour talk, Varoufakis traces the origins of the current economic crisis from 1929 through the New Deal, through World War II, through Bretton Woods to 2008 and beyond. And all in 24 minutes. Varoufakis is weaving in illuminating historic facts, such as why bankers were not allowed to participate in the drafting of Bretton Woods, how the Marshall Plan saved the U.S. economy, how Bretton Woods collapsed in the 1970s, and why and how bankers became instrumental in rescuing the U.S. from collapse after the U.S. bankrupted itself by going on a global shopping spree, and why we need a new deal. Yanis Varoufakis was already an internationally known economist and academic when he was elected to the Greek parliament as a member of the Syriza party at the height of the Greek debt crisis. He served as Minister of Finance in 2015. He resigned in protest over the imposition of structural adjustment and bailout loans on the Greek people, loans that then were used to bail out the banks. Varoufakis said that this was a transfer of losses from private banks to Greece's and Europe's taxpayers. Here is Yanis Varoufakis.
Something fundamental happened beginning in this country in the 1970s. After the end of Bretton Woods, which was what? What was Bretton Woods? Let's not get complicated. It was the globalization of the New Deal. Roosevelt's New Deal in 1933, which was, what was the basic idea? To put the financial genie, the banking genie, back into its bottle, to make banking boring, effectively to ban bankers from doing things that allowed too much money to be created and too many bubbles to be built up, mobilizing idle savings, the idle savings of the richer members of society, and putting those idle savings, turning them into a force in the public interest, infrastructural works, public works, education, social security, and so on. That was the New Deal. In 1944, towards the end of the war, the New Dealers extended that New Deal internationally as Europe was just a pile of ashes. Japan, you don't need me to explain what happened to Japan in 1945. So Bretton Woods, it was a magnificent system. Think about it. The United States officialdom in D.C. effectively designed a global capitalist system that was like a planned economy. You have fixed exchange rates, 4% interest rates forever, 20 years of 4% interest rates, no ups and downs. It was maybe plus or minus 0.1%. So you knew what your mortgage rate would be in the next 20 years. You knew if you wanted to change dollars for British pounds, you knew how many pounds you would get. You would get the same quantity year in, year out. So it was a world which was a nightmare for financiers. And, of course, that was by design. Did you know that in the Bretton Woods Conference in New Hampshire in 1944, Roosevelt imposed one single rule on his own? The rest he left to his minions. There were representatives from 100 different countries. Most of them already, they were not even liberated yet. They were under occupation because it was 1944. The Second World War had not ended. Experts, diplomats, politicians, and so on. One species of humanity was banned from entering the Washington Hotel bankers. A whole monetary global system was created on condition that bankers would not be part of it. Yeah? Interesting. You know, if anybody proposed this today, they would be immediately be branded as raving communist lunatics. This was Bretton Woods, 1944. You know, it's important to think back about possibilities when we think of what is possible. But that system collapsed towards the end of the 1960s, officially 15th of August 1971, with Nixon's announcement that it's kaput, it's finished. I'm not going to go into this. But what happened after that was a very interesting, fascinating reversal in the flow of trade and money around the world. Before the collapse of Bretton Woods, what was happening was this. This is how Bretton Woods was designed. America was a surplus country, especially after the Second World War, was the only creditor country, the only country that had the surpluses, financial surpluses, surpluses of goods, a net exporter. And what the United States administration did as part of Bretton Woods was to say, okay, the only way of preventing a return of the Great Depression to this land, number one, we convert all the factories from military production to civilian production, producing white goods instead of tanks and bullets, producing cars instead of aircraft carriers. Right, but that's not enough, because those factories during the war economy were so productive in this country that they were capable of producing so many washing machines, tractors, and cars that Americans would simply not have enough use for them. The only way of preventing the Great Depression from returning was by selling them to the Europeans. But the Europeans didn't have money. So new dealers, being very practical people, said, we'll give them the money. It's what's called the Marshall Aid Plan. For 20 years, United States was recycling about 70% of American profits in Japan and in Europe, because this is how what you do if you're a clever hegemon. What you do is you make sure that the only way that you can continue to have surpluses vis-a-vis somebody else is to finance them. Because if you don't, then they won't be able to afford to buy your stuff. Then you won't be able to have surpluses. The problem was, however, that those surpluses disappeared by the late 60s. America shifted from a surplus position to a deficit position. Both the government went in deficit and the American economy developed a trade deficit. It is fascinating that what happened after the collapse of Bretton Woods had been imagined by some smart fellows in this country. Remember Henry Kissinger? Yeah. He's a smart cookie, right? And in 1970, a year before the end of Bretton Woods, he was not yet Secretary of State. He was still head of the National Security Council. And of course, you know, he's a cold warrior, geopolitical thinker. He thinks in terms of, you know, a bit like Metternich would have in the 19th century. So he asked all the people that were working for him the pertinent question. Now that the United States is shifting into a deficit position, how can we maintain our global hegemony? All empires, superpowers, fell once they became deficit countries or economic blocks. A young man wrote a memo, 3/4 of a page. It was the most brilliant reply, and the one that really explains what happened between the 1970s and 2008 in the world, and of course in the United States. His answer was, it doesn't really matter whose surpluses are being recycled. What really matters to maintain in control is to be the one who is recycling other people's surpluses. Get it? We can maintain our superpower status, our hegemony, as long as we do the recycling of surpluses, even if the surpluses are not ours. Think about it. This is exactly the model that we have been living through between the 1970s and 2008. America turned into a deficit country. Now, Donald Trump is complaining, oh, you know, we have a huge trade deficit with China, with Germany. We need to eliminate it. Either he's completely unschooled or he's lying, or both. Globalization would not have happened without the American deficits. The American trade deficit operated like a gigantic vacuum cleaner that was sucking into this country the net exports of Germany, of Holland, of France, of Japan, and later, of course, of China. keeping those factories going at full blast. Eh? And this deficit kept increasing. It is this increasing American trade deficit that kept globalized capitalism in rude health. Now, of course, the question then is, how was it being paid for? Because Greece had a big deficit, and look at what happened to us. Well, this is the exorbitant privilege of the United States of America. At the very same time that the trade deficit was expanding, the rest of the world was sending to this country 70% of all profits the Germans made, the Dutch made, the Japanese made, and the Chinese are making. 70% of global profits were coming into Wall Street, seeking higher returns, being used to purchase U.S. Treasury bills, you know, American government debt. And so you had a pure recycling loop. So recycling was discovered by this young man, whose name, by the way, is Paul Volcker, who then became the chairman of the Fed, and who, just a week before he assumed the position of chairman of the Fed, in a lecture he gave at the University of Warwick in England, he said, this is the time when a controlled disintegration of the world economy is in the interest of the United States of America, verbatim. I've learned this off by heart because it's so exciting. The controlled disintegration of the world economy, so that's what he meant. So you had this amazing system where you have increasing imbalances globally, America growing its deficits, Germany and Japan and then China growing its surpluses. When we increase our deficit, we are creating an imbalance. When somebody else is increasing their surplus, that's an imbalance. And globalization was based on this. Financialization. What's financialization? Why was Wall Street allowed to go crazy? Why were all the checks and balances that the new dealers introduced and Bretton Woods introduced, why did they go to the dogs? Why did Larry Summers, why was he allowed to commit the crime against logic and humanity, to unleash the Wall Street bankers from their shackles, the result being 2008? The answer is because without unleashing the Wall Street bankers, it was impossible to close that loop. The only way you could have this model of the world economy where the United States deficit was keeping the rest of globalization going, with the rest of the world sending its surpluses into Wall Street for Wall Street to close the loop and pay for the deficit, was to let the Wall Street bankers do as they pleased. And when you do let the Wall Street bankers do as they please, you know what they do? You give a banker a few billion every day, for 5 minutes. Just park 5 billion with a banker for 5 minutes every day. This is to invite them to create very sophisticated bets using that 5 billion every day that they are always going to win. The problem is that they built so many pyramids of financialized derivatives on top of this tsunami of capital that the rest of the world was saying that it combusted in 2008. And the result was what we're facing. The point I'm making is that all power ended up with finance. Because if you allow bankers to push their hand into the future so majestically, frequently, and without any kind of control, to bring value that has not been produced yet into the future and effectively to appropriate it themselves. And then you also say to them that they're too big to fail, and when they fail, you know, then austerity for all is combined with socialism for the bankers, then they have no reason why not to keep undermining capitalism again and again and again. So I remember the one long conversation, longish conversation I had with Barack Obama when I was the finance minister of Greece. The first thing he said to me was, I feel solidarity for the Greek people and we are behind you, but there's not much I can do to help. Okay? And then he immediately, without me saying anything, he went into a soliloquy justifying himself by saying, you know, when I got elected, I realized there was nothing I could do because Wall Street had just imploded and I had to save them. And that was, he said, political poison for me. Now, I don't know whether he believed it or not. And I can't see how he can explain the fact that he appointed Larry Summers to sort out the mess. Unless, of course, you know, you adopt the cynical view that it takes a murderer to work out how the criminal justice system should be reformed. This is effectively the point I'm making. So, is capitalism consistent or sustainable within a democratic polity? Can it coexist with democracy? Absolutely not. Because capitalism is generating this shift of power away from the political sphere. And even if you have fantastically scripted constitutions, beautiful congresses with wonderful procedures and so on, power is going to shift away from those processes. They're going to become fig leaves for a system where power lives somewhere else. In my first meeting of finance ministers in Europe, I was exposed to this harsh reality, which I always knew, but it's one thing to know it as a radical lefty that theorizes, quite another to be told straight in your face. That was the beauty of those few months I spent in government, was exactly that. I didn't have to theorize anymore. I went to my first meeting of the Eurogroup. The Eurogroup is the meeting of the European Union finance ministers of the countries that share the same currency, the euro. So I walked in there and I tried to be as moderate as anyone who comes from a country that is bankrupt and whose new government has a title, or the party that won, Coalition of the Radical Left. Yeah? So there I was, the Minister of Finance representing the Coalition of the Radical Left in that cesspool of conservatism. All I said was, we are facing a challenge, colleagues, I said. There is the principle, I said, of continuity in liberal democracies. In other words, we're not going to start at year zero just because we were just elected. We have obligations to you that previous governments, Greek governments, have assumed, and which, of course, we were against, our party was against, but nevertheless, our state, because of the principle of continuity, still has these obligations to you, and therefore I cannot dismiss them. At the same time, there is another principle, the principle of democracy. I could see that they didn't like that very much. And the principle of democracy is very simple. I have a mandate from the people of Greece to challenge all these obligations that we have, this particular fiscal and monetary policy that you've been imposing upon my country, which led to a Great Depression, which led me to be here, because if we didn't have a Great Depression, the Greeks were not stupid enough to vote for me. You know, our party went from 4% to 40% in 2.5 years because of the Great Depression. And I said, well, what happens in a democracy when two principles clash, the principle of continuity and the principle of democracy? Well, we sit around the table like civilized people and we find a compromise. This is what democracies do, liberal democracies, yes? I sit down, the French minister loved what I said, of course, you know, just complete hot air. Yes, 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 yes. I could see Wolfgang Schäuble, the German finance minister, he was looking at me, and he gets the floor, and he said, one sentence. Elections cannot be allowed to change economic policy. My response was, this is excellent news to the Chinese Communist Party, because they believe that too. And I then came up with a proposal. This is why they hated me. I was very moderate. I said, in that case, Wolfgang, let's ban elections in bankrupt countries. Let's come out and declare that in the European Union, you can only have democracy if you're a creditor country. And also the proposal that we suspend elections while a country is in the red in the European Union. That would be more honest. So the reason why I'm mentioning this is that Schäuble was right. In the capitalist, the globalized, financialized capitalism that we have created, elections cannot be allowed to change economic policy. We live in pure ironclad oligarchies which require, for legitimation purposes and for their reproduction, that we think that we live in democracies. Now, the tragedy is that capitalism is being overthrown. not by the left, we are useless. Progressives, left-wingers, are a catastrophe. Eh? Let's face it, capitalism is overthrowing itself with no help from us. And it's doing it in two ways. Firstly, think of 2008. This financialization process that I described imploded under the weight of its own hubris. And the result is a never-ending crisis. Don't believe anybody who tells you that the 2008 crisis ended. It never ended. It is continuing. It is mutating. It's taking different forms. It migrates. It goes to different parts of the world. It takes, for instance, in Germany, it takes the form of negative interest rates that are eating into the pension funds of the average middle-class person, who then turns against the political system and votes for the fascists of the Alternative for Deutschland. They don't have unemployment, but they have this sense of deflation of their hard-earned savings that creates the rise of xenophobia, racism, and the ultra-right. In my country, we have a Nazi party in parliament because we have a Great Depression, because we have an unemployment rate of 30%. And we have no interest rates because nobody's lending to anyone, because everybody's bankrupt. Yeah. In China, you have an investment rate. The proportion of GDP, of national income, that goes into investment is gigantic. It's 48%. 48 cents to every dollar earned in China goes into investment. Now, investment is a good thing, but overinvestment simply means that the Chinese authorities have given up on the West. Because, let's face it, the only reason why you don't have a Great Depression in this country today is because in 2008, which was your version, our version of 1929, two things happened differently to what happened in 1929. One was that the Federal Reserve started printing money as if there's no tomorrow. Didn't happen in 1929. And the second thing was China boosted its investment ratio so high in order to rebalance global capitalism. They did it very well, but it's not sustainable. So Europe is not sustainable, China is not even sustainable, and the United States today, which is celebrating growth, what growth? You have 2.5% growth. All the things that shouldn't grow, grow. The things that should grow are not growing. You do not have any serious investment in good quality jobs in this country. You have wage stagnation. This idiocy of the Democratic Party that Putin won the election against Hillary Clinton. Come on, wake up. You cannot say to Trump voters that they're idiots and Putin duped them. I mean, you can say that, but then that's it. You lose them forever. And it's also not true. People say to me, well, how do you explain that Trump won? I'm an economist, so I look at numbers. The number that I think is most spectacular in this country is that in 2016, more than half of the families in this country could not afford the cheapest new car, which cost $14,000. Either they didn't have the money, or they didn't have the money and they did not have the credit ratings necessary to borrow $14,000. More than half of the families cannot afford the cheapest car. That's why Trump got elected. Because Obama failed spectacularly to shift the burdens of the crisis of the financial sector onto the 0.1%. So, let's end on a positive note. Shall we? Technically, it's really very simple how to solve the problem. We need a new deal, except that this must be an international new deal, exactly as the new deal was in 1933, but globally. That's not new. Bretton Woods was an international new deal. So we need a new Bretton Woods. We need progressives in this country, progressives in Europe, to get their act together and start collaborating and start believing that it is possible to do that which has already been done before. It's not pie-in-the-sky stuff. Now, this in order to ameliorate the effects of the ongoing crisis after 2008. Then once we stabilize the world, like Bretton Woods stabilized the world after the Second World War, then we can start thinking about post-capitalism. Because we must. Capitalism is overturning itself, not only through its crisis, but also through the technologies that it is creating. 3D printing, artificial intelligence, the internet will make sure that in a few years there will be no need to have a corporation. Corporations will lack their raison d'etre. The only reason why you have General Motors is economies of scale. Economies of scale are dying because of the new technologies that capitalism is creating. you are going to have a situation in which we are going to have magnificent productivity, magnificent capacity to produce stuff, but the large majority will not be able to buy any of it. So that will be a crisis of not just the poor and the have-nots, but also the haves. But we must never believe that because there's going to be a crisis of capitalism, because capitalism is going to undermine and overthrow itself, good things will happen. In the 1930s, capitalism imploded and Nazism happened. So we can have one certainty: capitalism cannot maintain itself. Something else, another system of organizing economic and political life is going to follow. And we better make sure that the way in which we choose as a species, as a humanity, that different way of doing things is selected democratically. Because even though democracy takes too long, as Oscar Wilde said, socialism would never happen because it takes too many long evenings. And it's tedious. There's no doubt about that. If you've been to a political meeting, you know how tedious it is. It's the only choice we have. And thankfully, we are creating the technologies that will make these debates both more manageable and more hopeful in terms of delivering a future that resembles, as I say in the book, Star Trek and not The Matrix. Thank you.
That was Yanis Varoufakis, professor of economics and former Greek finance minister. You heard an excerpt from his Cambridge Forum talk, How Capitalism Fails. Is Capitalism Devouring Democracy? You can find the full talk on YouTube. Varoufakis had been invited to the U.S. to talk about his most recent book, Talking to My Daughter About the Economy. Among his other books are Adults in the Room and The Weak Suffer What They Must, and The Global Minotaur, America, the True Causes of the Financial Crisis and the Future of the World Economy. Yanis Varoufakis is a co-founder of an international grassroots Democracy in Europe movement, 2025. After teaching for many years in the United States, Great Britain, and Australia, he's currently professor of economics at the University of Athens. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
And we're back. It is the Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM, and I think we're joined by the author, Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
It's very good to have you with us, Stephen, because you've just written a new analysis of the situation in Syria, which it's a very important indictment. Your argument is among it, and by the way, it's titled... Well, now I suddenly look and I can't find a bit that... economic atom, and that's why I forget. The economic atom bombing of Syria. And the argument is that this sanctions and economic warfare is as damaging as bombing a city in terms of what it does to an economy.
Yes. Can be as damaging, if not more damaging, and perhaps in many instances far more devastating. And I think this is kind of established in connection with the sanctions on Iraq in the 1990s. There were two political scientists in the United States, John Mueller and Carl Mueller, who wrote an article for Foreign Affairs, which is kind of the unofficial journal of the U.S. State Department. And they showed that the sanctions inflicted upon Iraq during the 1990s produced more deaths than all the weapons of mass destruction in history, including the chemical weapons used in
and
the...
What were those deaths? Tell us, is it disease? Is it lack of medicine? You also make the point, I think they do too, is that these are the kind of deaths which are undramatic in that they're, person goes, there is not necessary facilities right for them, and then they go away quietly and disappear.
Yeah, they're undramatic. So in their case, what they did was they cited 500,000, over 500,000 deaths of children under the age of five due to disease and malnutrition, which the UN agency had brought forward. So this is only in their children under the age of five. It doesn't include everyone else. Mm-hmm. And this was never contested by the United States.
Well, it was acknowledged in the one case by famously, I guess we should all thank her for her callousness, but Madeleine Albright was asked, was it worth it to kill that 500,000 died? She didn't dispute the number. She said it was worth it.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, it was far more than 500,000, but they accepted, let's accept 500,000. And then they looked at the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and said, well, maybe, at most that led to 200,000 deaths. So, in effect, the economic element of war in Iraq was such that it was equivalent to, in terms of the death toll, in terms of two economic atom bombs. But it was largely unseen. The effects were largely unseen. I mean, you'd see the effects, or not the effects. I mean, atom bombing is quite visible and quite alarming. Sanctions are not visible, and the effects of sanctions are not alarming as a result of not being visible, but they have the same kind of lethal consequences as military intervention.
This is Stephen Gallins, and the point additionally is that, in fact, this is illegal. It's outside UN sanctions. I shouldn't say UN sanctions. These are not a result of something that went to the United Nations Security Council where it is possible to get sanctions on a country. We're looking at North Korea, I guess, as an example. But the activity against Syria is entirely outside the United Nations Security Council. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, these are so-called unilateral sanctions or unilateral, economic coercion undertaken outside or without the authorization of the UN Security Council and therefore illegal. And they also violate all kinds of resolutions that have been passed by the United Nations General Assembly. So they're contrary to international law, contrary to international humanitarian law, to the UN Charter, and to the norms and principles governing peaceful relations among states. Mm-hmm. And this was a point that has been brought up by the Special Rapporteur on Syria, who released a report in May, which was his end-of-mission statement. It was titled End-of-Mission Statement on the Negative Impact of Unilateral Coercive Measures on the Enjoyment of Human Rights on the Syrian Arab Republic. And he, or she, I'm not sure if it was a male or female, but the special rapporteur concluded that the claims that sanctions exist to protect the Syrian population which is the pretext used by the United States and the EU and Canada and Australia. This claim, you know, that they're there to protect the Syrian population or to promote a democratic transition are, quote, hard to reconcile with the economic and humanitarian suffering being caused. And what the special rapporteur did was point out that not only are these sanctions illegal, but they have far-reaching consequences for the daily lives of Syrians. And they also happen to be structured in a way that prevent or at least impede the delivery of humanitarian aid.
Yeah, I know you make a very good point in the latter part of the article. You say that the way that it's done is to have a chilling effect on anybody who would like to deliver humanitarian assistance or who would in ordinary conditions would be able to do it. But they are afraid that they can't – because it's a complex arrangement, they don't know whether they're in violation or not, and so therefore they don't take the chance.
Yeah, they're afraid of running afoul of the U.S. and U.N. sanctions, and therefore it's not worth a business or a firm or an organization to become involved in delivering humanitarian aid to Syria because there are potential penalties. So they simply avoid this as a hazard. And the result is that humanitarian aid doesn't get delivered. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sanctions that were built in such a way as to permit the provision of, you know, humanitarian aid, food, health, medicine, drugs, et cetera. But owing to this fear and the chilling effect, these services and these commodities don't get delivered in the way they're supposed to.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting to watch it, just how powerful the U.S. is. And I notice that this is all based on their own legislation. They have things like the Syria Accountability Act, the Patriot Act, and the Economic Powers Act. That's all American legislation that they're imposing on the world, right?
Yes. And these sanctions on Syria go back to 1979. That's not often recognized. Often when we think about sanctions against Syria, we think they began in 2011, you know, coincident with the Islamist uprising. But in fact, they go back much longer. They're part of Washington's long war on Syria. So in 1979, the United States imposed sanctions on the country, designating Syria a state sponsor of terrorism, citing its support for, you know, groups engaged in the anti-colonial struggle against Israel. So these are particularly, you know, the Palestinian groups and Hezbollah. And then those sanctions were intensified in 2003. And this is a really interesting story that's not well known. Washington contemplated an invasion of Syria in 2003, following the invasion of Iraq. I mean, they're in Iraq. They might as well extend the invasion to neighboring Syria. But they discovered that, you know, the pacifying Iraq and pacifying Afghanistan, which had been invaded 2 years earlier, was much more difficult than they had anticipated. And that militated against additional expenditures of blood and treasure.
The locals were not greeting them with flowers and applause.
Right. So they looked for an alternative. And the alternative was to pressure Syria through sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, what they did was they banned U.S. exports to Syria. And perhaps more effectively, they banned all U.S. banks dealing with the Central Bank of Syria, essentially cutting Syria off from the world banking system.
Yeah, and you quote them that among the things that the reason they had to do with that was because Syria had a Soviet model economic system.
Yes, I mean,
it needed to be changed.
They cited a number of things, and who was involved in this, right at the center of this, was John Bolton, the current National Security Advisor.
The mustache.
Yes. He accused, he accused the Syrian government of developing biological weapons and nuclear weapons. And I mean, the same kind of pretext they'd used to invade Iraq, he tried to apply to Syria. And then they complained about Syria's support for Palestinian liberation groups and Hezbollah, and also complained about the economy of Syria. And these complaints have been made frequently by the State Department. They have what they call Soviet models. That's the way they've been described by U.S. Congressional Research Service, or they haven't opened themselves up to neoliberal reforms and so on. Essentially, Syria has resisted having its economy annexed by the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had just recently, I want your thoughts on this, we had the G7, which was quite a clown show, as people describe it, where the embarrassing thing at the end of the G7 meeting was that President Trump flew away and did not sign the final document. But I've looked at the final document. It's a horror story of colonialist thinking. I noticed that they are very strong against Syria, and their language is that they call it a regime. Of course, Syria is a member of the United Nations. It is a government. It is sovereign, recognized as one of the early members of the UN. But the G7 just complacently says, well, it's a regime, and it's done all these – we wanted to do something on chemical weapons. And yet, as I judge from your article, Canada has been happily participating in illegal sanctions and conduct towards Syria, reflected in language like the regime.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, by the way, when you decided it's not a government but it is a regime, you really are destabilizing or attempting to destabilize it. You're actually calling on its citizens to remove it.
Yeah, it's part of the defamation, demonizing the government. And Canada simply follows suit, follows the United States lead, which is why Canada is participating in the sanctions. But, you know, this is all kind of nauseating in a way, to talk about Syria as a regime or to talk about the imposition of sanctions as a way of bringing about a democratic transition. Not only nauseating because it's so far removed from the truth and so hypocritical. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you think about this, who are the major allies of the United States and Canada in the Arab world? The major allies are Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan. I mean, these are absolutist monarchies which tolerate no democracy whatsoever.
Yes.
Another huge ally is Egypt, which is essentially has a virtual military dictatorship.
Yeah. Well, and somebody pointed out yesterday that Saudi Arabia said that it didn't think there would have been free and fair elections in Turkey. And somebody said, who said that? What? You can see that irony is against the law in Syria, I think. Pardon me, in Saudi Arabia.
Yes, it is.
No jokes about the monarchs.
Yeah.
Well, what about – you cite Article 5 of the UN Declaration on Rights, Right to Development. I really like that. Could you talk about that? The right of governments to – I mean, this is part of the – decolonization process, the right of independent states to their economic development.
Yes, and the Article 5 says that states shall take steps to eliminate massive and flagrant violations of human rights of people affected by situations such as those resulting from foreign domination and occupation, aggression, foreign interference and threats against national sovereignty, threats against territorial integrity, threats of war, refusal to recognize the fundamental rights of people to self-determination. Well, you know, notwithstanding this declaration, Washington and its allies, including Canada, have actively taken steps to interfere in Syria's internal affairs, to issue threats of war, to undertake aggressions, to violate Syria's internal integrity, or territorial integrity, and to occupy part of its territory. So in other words, Washington and his allies do precisely what this declaration asks states not to do. And yet the United States and Canada and its allies, you know, parade about the world as the privileged interpreters of human rights and the great champions of human rights while violating the rights of Syrians.
Yeah, it's almost sadistic. You quote the New York Times, Washington Post, and I believe it was Foreign Affairs as well, that, you know, they pretend they're sort of sitting in the bleachers and they say, oh, it looks like Syria's buckling. Its economy is failing. And, and that's more like a weather report on your determination to cause them to break and fail.
Yes. And then interestingly, I mean, that New York Times report about the sanctions causing Syria's economy to buckle was from 2011. I mean, that's 7 years ago.
Yeah.
Sanctions have had seven more years to have an impact. So even early on, they were having this devastating impact on the country. But no one talks about that. And I mean, they're formidable, or there are all kinds of consequences. One of the consequences is to, you know, induce massive migration from the country. You flee the country because once you've essentially created the breakdown of the economy, there are no jobs for people. Your infrastructure is crumbling. Government support systems are crumbling. The healthcare system is in tatters. So people leave the country.
Mm-hmm.
You have a massive migration.
But also makes those migrants something of, I get the impression sometimes that they are almost becoming hostages in that when, for example, the Aleppo is liberated and some people begin to go back, there signs of alarm come from Western capitals. Oh, you can't go back. That's a terrible dictatorship. That's that, you know, and we don't think it's safe. And you hear behind that the kind of the strong suggestion, we're not even going to let you go back.
Yeah. But another part of the migration crisis or some other aspect that deserves attention, which the special rapporteur mentioned in the report, was that what some states do that accept refugees, Syrian refugees, is they accept those who are perhaps the most well-educated, for example, and don't accept those who aren't. So the result is that you also have a brain drain.
Yes.
But I should also point out, you know, I mean, you mentioned about you can't go back there because it's a vile dictatorship. But we should point out, I mean, I pointed out that U.S. allies in the region are mostly absolutist monarchies or a Herrenvolk democracy, as I called Israel, by which I meant it's a democracy for the Jews, but a Jewish state for Arabs. But if we look at Syria, Syria is one of the few countries in the Arab world that has an elected legislature, has an elected president, and in the last election, presidential election, had multiple candidates. So Syria is far closer to the Western ideal of a multi-party democracy than the major allies in the Arab world of the United States. So how Canada and the United States and the European Union can accuse Syria of being a dictatorship is,
if I follow your article, it's because they've committed the crime of anti-colonialism. They still don't accept the idea that there is superpower hegemony in their region.
No, exactly. And, you know, there's an interview with the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, that's on the Syrian Arab News Agency website, and it was done by a Russian news media organization. I think it was done yesterday. And, I mean, Assad has always been quite clear that that Syria is an independent country. It's an independent country working for the interest of Syrians, that the West doesn't give, it just takes, wants to take from Syria, and the Syrians or the Syrian government has no intention of allowing its sovereignty to be limited or to be subordinated or to be integrated into this kind of U.S. empire. Mm-hmm. But that's what the United States does to countries that refuse to be absorbed into its empire.
You know, I'm struck by this, Stephen, particularly reading your article. And I really urge everybody to get it, by the way. It's what's at the column is What's Left. You can find it on the Internet, and it's Stephen Gowans, and it's The Economic Atom Bomb of Syria, June 23rd. What we're really, in a way, seeing is a revival of the old revival of the old arguments between colonial thinking and anti-colonial thinking. And frankly, until now, until recent years, the neo-colonial thinking has been prevailing. But I notice you cite a figure like Frantz Fanon, who couldn't be more accurate. He says, and you quote him, the attitude of the colonial powers was, oh, you want to be independent? Well, okay. You're going to be very independent. We're not going to help you at all. We're going to make you miserable.
Yes. If you want independence, then take it and die of hunger.
That's a line. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the United States has been doing this for quite some time. I mean, this goes back even, for example, to the Bolshevik Revolution, when U.S. figures are responsible for providing food aid, said, well, we'd only provide maybe food aid in certain areas which were opposed to the Bolsheviks and not provide food aid where they were. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, this is a recurring element in U.S. foreign policy, is to use starvation or the threat of starvation to coerce countries, or economic degradation to coerce countries into bowing to U.S. demand.
Mm-hmm. You also give a formula for what we ought to actually do, particularly for those who regard themselves as socialists or internationalists, or this strange word, the left, which is hard to pin down in North America and Europe. But you say it's absolutely essential that they oppose sanctions. And you, by the way, how can anybody argue with your point when it's illegal? So how could they adopt a complacent attitude, well, play a pox on both your houses? Well, one state is behaving illegally toward the other. Why doesn't the left manage to see that?
Yeah, I mean, they don't see that. Often they don't know that these sanctions are illegal.
They read the New York Times, therefore they're not adequately informed.
Yeah, often they don't know that the sanctions are even in place. And when they do know that sanctions are in place, they often think that the sanctions have no impact or very little impact on the civilian population and are aimed at the leadership, never recognizing that, in fact, sanctions always have widespread impacts on the civilian population. And they just don't grab people's attention the way that bombing does. For example, I mean, the cruise missile attack, Trump's cruise missile attack, the latest one on on Syria, that arrested a lot of attention. But in effect, it was theater. Mm-hmm. But if we look at sanctions, which have been going on for many years, which aren't theater and have enormous consequences, most people really don't recognize that. But it's hard to recognize. Perhaps it's difficult to blame people for not recognizing that which is kind of concealed and not presented to them. However, I think that there's this obligation on the part of the left in the West to pressure Western governments to abandon these projects of economic coercion.
Yeah.
Part of this, I think, involves lifting the humanitarian veil behind which the ugly face of sanctions has been concealed.
Well, we have in our hemisphere the issue of Cuba, where the Cubans suffer punishment just daily of not being able to access capital and goods. And by the way, that's your second point on what the left should be doing, which is countries have the right to develop when we should be encouraging that And if you wanted to be selfish about it, obviously we would all benefit.
Yeah, they have the right to develop. That's also enshrined in kind of international humanitarian law. And there's also a prohibition against denying countries their means of subsistence, which is precisely what Western sanctions do. It denies developing countries the means of subsistence. But they should have the right to pursue self-directed economic development. And part of that is not only so that they can develop, and also so that they can achieve some kind of national security, which they don't have now because they're dependent upon the West. And I thought it was interesting that Donald Trump has justified the imposition of tariffs on national security grounds, saying, well, you know, national security is economic security. Unless we have economic security, we don't really have national security. Well, the same applies, but to a greater extent, to underdeveloped countries, which can hardly have national security if they're economically dependent upon the West and can be coerced so easily through Western sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and where they've had, and you've written about Korea, illustrating all this, that book is Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, A Story of Korea's Struggle for Freedom. But that's certainly the story of North Korea, right? Is it because of the sanctions and the existence of a war that has not ended, it has, of course, affected their ability to develop, because the first issue was their ability to secure themselves against an aggressor.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's an economic war that's been waged on them two ways. One is by forcing them to devote resources that would have otherwise gone to economic development to the military in order to defend themselves from these incessant threats of invasion. And then there's the economic warfare of, you know, the sanctions and financial isolation. And then on top of that, there's this propaganda war that says, well, look at these economies. I mean, it's underdeveloped, it's stunted. That must mean there's economic mismanagement.
Mm-hmm. In a quick moment, you do stress that China is a kind of a model that is really broken free. You say it's China versus 500 years of colonial oppression, that they do offer kind of some security and an example.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, if you think about the so-called Great Divergence began 500 years ago when Europe plundered the Americas and one part of the world, this minority of countries developed and the remainder of the world, the majority, didn't develop and was held down. Who's challenged that? I mean, we've had this great wave of anti-colonialization where countries have achieved political independence, but the only country to ever really challenge the Great Divergence has been China.
Yeah. I'm going to have to close it there, but I got you on the right sentence. That's the one I was looking for.
Okay.
Steve Gowans, it's a great pleasure. Thanks for being on the Taylor Report.
Thank you. Bye.
See you. Bye-bye. And it's Taylor Report, and you can find us on Facebook.
Yeah, the Taylor Report on Facebook and Taylor-Report on SoundCloud.
All right. Well, thanks, Michael. We'll see you next week.